Okay, Ghana Week of the Committee. I was in local government 1 year in Johannesburg from 1995 to 2000. And I served in the tender committee there. 2004, I came over here, served in mineral and energy, public works, communication, local government and provinces, and a few more committees.
Thank you very much. We will now cross over to your team prof, Professor Kadi.
My name is Jeffrey Mabilibe. I'm the CEO of ISA.
Thank you very much.
Adam Habib, I'm the bureaucrat at Zips University. I'm also for today the chair of ISA itself.
Thank you very much. We're happy to have you here.
I'm Max Cry. He's a bureaucrat on the apparatchik at the University of Cape Town, and I'm the deputy chair of ISA.
Thank you very much. We're happy to have you here.
Good morning, honorable members. I'm Marshall Bima Bizela. I'm the real bureaucrat from the Department of Higher Education and Training.
Bureaucrats are also welcome. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Susi Somlani, the parliamentary liaison officer in the office of the deputy minister.
Thank you very much, sir.
I'm the first name, the parliamentary liaison officer for the office of the minister.
Thank you very much, ma'am. You are all welcome. Next, the gentleman over that side. Please open your... Oh, you don't have mic. Okay, that's fine. Thank you so much. So I was not wrong when I said we are globally connected. Thank you. I will now ask our officials to introduce themselves, starting from here.
Anneli Kabilis, Commissioner.
Good morning. Lindum Zikomle, Special for the Committee.
A former lecturer. Yes. Okay. We call it learnership. I'm sure he's on a learnership program. Okay. Who else has not introduced himself? I think we... Come again. Okay, Chantel.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Chantel Ball. I'm the secretary to the WIP for Comrade Danny Kekana.
All right. Thank you so much. Now that we know who is in this house, I am again going to ask you to feel free. This is our meeting. Let us engage meaningfully with one another, and what key is that we have fruitful deliberation and achieve on the purpose of this meeting. Now, the purpose of this meeting is to learn more about HISA, and also we will then use interrogation on the presentation on the presentation by HISA. But thank you very much. Before we then proceed to the actual briefing, we are now in apologies. I have received apologies from the Honorable Minister and the Deputy Minister. Not to say they do not take this meeting seriously, but unfortunately, because of two competing needs, they also are expected to sit in the cabinet today. So this day is not the right one for us as a committee, but we only we actually meet on this day as a committee. This is the day that was allocated for our committee work. But then when they are not busy, I do want to inform Prof, they really do come. to our meetings. But when there are serious cabinet issues, let's be honest, you would also prioritize the cabinet. Put in their position, you prioritize the cabinet. All right, but then we also have received an apology from Professor Kubisa, who also has got two, you know, demanding meetings. But then this time he had to attend the other one. When we discussed in this, we thought that I think it will be to the best interest of the institution for him to attend the other one. Now these are the four apologies that we have received, and these are written apologies, but thank you very much. I'm sure we accept the apologies. Do we accept the apologies? Yes, Chantel?
Thank you, Chair. Komedani, would you like to say something?
No, Chair. You remember I have a dentist appointment at 11, and I'd like to be released at 11.
Okay. Mr. Ketane would like to be released at 11. And then who else is Ms. Killian?
Chairperson, unfortunately, I'd like to leave the meeting at 12:15.
Because we've got another meeting. Yes, we've discussed that. Okay. Ms. Killian will have to leave this meeting because of another meeting that she has to attend today. I see Mr. Chishonga.
Yes, madam. I didn't attend the BRR yesterday, and I think a special session has been arranged today.
Yes.
I was.
But it's at 9.
Yes.
All right. No, that's fine. You'll be excused. At the time when you feel like you're okay, you can. Yeah, you'll be excused. All right. We have received the apologies. May I check with the members of the committee if they accept the apologies? You do so by show of hands, because if you nod, I don't know what you're nodding for. It could be that you're thinking, you know, quietly thinking to yourself. All right. Professor Bozoli is proposing that we accept. Any seconder? Okay. Ms. Nkunu and Ms. Nkadime. Thank you very much. We will now proceed to item number 3, which is briefing by Higher Education South Africa on internationalization, research and innovation in higher education. Now, my request is that as the committee members, we listen carefully, isolate those key issues that you would like to rise on after the presentation, and also we then engage in a meaningful discussion after the presentation. I will now call upon Professor Habib. I've got to acknowledge the chairperson. It's called protocol. So I'll call upon Professor Habib to then lead us through the presentation.
Colleagues, thank you very much. Our CEO to make the presentation, and then we obviously, Max and I, will be happy to deal with some of the questions that we'll just
have. Thank you very much. Over to you, Chester.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, members of the Portfolio Committee, colleagues from the department, and officials from Parliament.
Dr. Mabelevele, I'm still learning, I've been corrected. Let me address you accordingly. I will now call upon Dr. Mabelevele to brief us.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Well,
Honorable Chairman, I'm going to give a high-level input because we proceed from the premise that the presentation has been shared, and therefore we assume also that it has been read, and we'll just highlight some of the few salient points to prepare ourselves for a discussion. In terms of the outline, we thought we should reflect very briefly on the size, shape, and funding of higher education system in our country before we come to the two main issues that we were called upon to brief the Portfolio Committee on, which is internationalization, research, and innovation. And lastly, then we'll conclude our input. we are all familiar with this whole school education and training system that is emerging. And as you know, the post-school system comprises of the university sector, the TVET college sector, and the now emerging a community college sector. As you can see on the slide that we are currently showing, the university sector remains the biggest in terms of numbers, followed by the TVET college sector and the emerging community college sector. But there is an emerging challenge which we have noted, and the policy documents of the department has also noted, that we still have about 2.9 million students, potential students, 18 to 24 year olds, who are not currently in education, who are not currently in employment or in training. And as you can see, the university sector has been absorbing a large percentage of students of the post-school system. Now, in terms of funding, university receives funding from three sources: from government, from student fees, and from tax stream income. The slide that we're showing here demonstrates that in the last 10 years or so, the proportion of government subsidy has been declining in real terms. And that decline has been putting pressure on the other two categories sources of funding, meaning student fees and tax-free income. As government funding declines, universities are left with very few options but to intensify their efforts to raise funds from research consultancy work, from other related activities, self-stream income, that is, but also to increase student fees in order to balance their books. That has been a conundrum that the university sector has been faced with over the last few years. And it seems that with the projected growth, Honorable Chair, of the system from just close to 1 million now to around 1.6 million in 2030, if nothing is done and done urgently, we are going to see student fees and self-stream income being put under even more severe pressure. And we thought we should put that across as we engage on this issue. Now, expenditure on education as a percent of GDP. South Africa is not spending much compared to other countries, including, amongst other things, emerging economies. We are only spending about 0.71%. On higher education as a percentage of GDP. Whereas other countries like Brazil, as you can see, Argentina, are spending quite a sizable amount of money on higher education. In fact, Cuba is spending about 4.47% as a percentage of GDP. And again, the call here is to really highlight, underscore an important issue, that if we are to succeed in projecting education as an apex priority, that call has to be supported by adequate funding. We have got to fund our system adequately to ensure that our system delivers on what has been called upon to deliver. Now, in terms of student enrollment, the higher education sector has been growing rapidly since 2010. As you can see, the 2012 figures, which are audited, we are now sitting at 953,000 students. The preliminary figures that the department is still to audit and finalize suggest that we are sitting at around 983, that's the 2013 figures, 983,000 students. Again, the number of international students has been increasing very steadily. And if you take UNISA out of the equation, the system has not been growing as massively as one would have expected. That the number of full-time equivalent days. UNISA has been helping us a great deal, although other universities have been assisting here and there. Now, in terms of postgraduate students, again, we have seen an increase from 2010 to 2013. However, that has not been matched up by an increase in the number of permanent instruction research staff. As you can see, in 2010, we had about 16,000 academics. 2,800 academics. That does not take into account the growth of the system. If you correlate the growth of the system to the number of academic staff growth, you will find that there is a big delta there. And that has a huge impact on issues of quality and other related matters. And again, we have seen a steady increase in the number of foreign academics in our system from about 1.4 to about 2,200 academics. Now, what does what do all these figures say? In our view, these figures suggest that state funding of higher education in health has been declining over the years, an issue I've highlighted in my earlier input. But taken also, the state budget for universities as a percent of GDP is currently sitting at around 0.75 compared to 0.78 for Africa as a whole and 1.21 for OECD countries. Again, we are trying to emphasize the message that our system, compared to other systems in other parts of the world, seems not to be adequately funded. And that has been taken earlier on, puts pressure on student fees and first-term income. The funding for infrastructure as well. Even after the injection of the infrastructure efficiency grant in 2007, does not seem to match the current and projected growth of the system. So yes, the system has been growing, and that growth has been putting pressure on infrastructure. And again, investment infrastructure does not seem to address backlogs, infrastructure backlogs that our universities are currently experiencing. A major issue that you've also noted from the figures is that the student academic FTE ratio has been deteriorating over the years, an issue I've touched on in my earlier input as well. Now, coming back to the gist of the briefing, internationalization, we have really highlighted some of the things that we think are important for committee members to note in relation to internationalization. It has value, and one of its critical values for our university sector is that it helps us to improve quality of teaching and learning, as well as research. It also deepens our engagement as universities with national, regional, and global issues and stakeholders. But of importance to note also, it does prepare our students as national and global citizens and as productive members of the workforce, because they would be able to gain, amongst other things, intercultural competencies, global awareness, and other related skills that they sorely need to succeed as global and as national and global citizens. It also enhances opportunities for academic staff to interact with their counterparts in other parts of the world and to engage in joint research projects in order to solve not just the national issues, but also global related challenges. It goes against, Honorable Chairperson, the risk of academic inbreeding, because without internationalization, we'll only rely on academics coming from our own system. We wouldn't be able to open ourselves up as universities to academics from other systems of the world, and also learn from their own experiences on research and related matters. There are also wider benefits, the Honorable Chair and committee members, that accrue through internationalization to our own economy, to international students themselves, and to students' countries of origin. Half of those we have highlighted in the slide that I've just shown here. One, in terms of economic benefits of Africa, it goes without saying that the more students we have in our system, the better, because those students are able to recommend others to study in South Africa. And that also has an effect on a positive effect on our economy. But through this internationalization, we're able to import a skilled workforce to come and study in our universities. And once they study in our universities, they're able to take up occupations in South Africa's economy and contribute to the economic development of our country. As I've indicated also, it enriches the experience of our domestic students. It gives them skills that they solely need to compete in global affairs. there are benefits that also accrue to students themselves. They are able to get skills, marketable skills, intercultural competence, global awareness skills, foreign language skills, and so on and so forth. But also importantly for us is that we are able to contribute to the development of these students' countries of origin. Because as they complete their studies, Chairperson, Honorable Chairperson, these students are able to go back to their home countries and join a highly skilled workforce in those countries and contribute broadly to the development of their own countries. However, there are key questions that we thought we should put forward for the committee to consider discussing. The first point is that although we have been growing as a system, international students as a proportion of total enrollment currently sit at around 7.5%. Other systems in other parts of the world have between 15% and 30% of international students in their systems. And the question for us that we should discuss is an appropriate balance that has to be struck between local students and international students in South Africa, given the socio-economic challenges facing our country, but also the need for us to open up our system for our system to become also internationally competitive. In our view, South Africa should have this discussion because, one, if we open up our system for international students, particularly those postgraduate students who are coming with scholarships and bursaries, we would be able to help subsidize or cross-subsidize students who happen to come from poor socioeconomic backgrounds. We are saying that particularly postgraduate level, where we seem to be struggling with numbers, there is perhaps a need for us to consider attracting more international students into those postgraduate studies, assuming that they will be coming with scholarships and bursaries, and some of them are quite prestigious, Honorable Chair, to assist us in lessening, in augmenting our income, but also in lessening the pressure on both student tuition fees and testing income. And the more international students we have in our country, we will be able to contribute to the shifting of global perceptions about Africa, because those students will be able to come to some of our prestigious universities in the country and help us explore the brand value of South Africa as a destination for international students. We think it's very important for us to have that kind of a conversation. We understand that there are constraints that we need to address if we are to really position our system as an internationalized education system. Firstly, the size of our education system is very small, and that brings forth pressures of access for local students. We'll have to strike that balance very carefully to ensure that we do not prioritize international students at the expense of local students. Secondly, we need to improve very rapidly the policy and regulatory environment to create a conducive environment for international students and foreign academics to join our system. Firstly, the department has been working on this joint and double degree policy for some time now, and we think conditions have now ripened for the department to finalize the policy so that our universities can be in a position to enter into some form of partnerships with their counterparts in other parts of the world and collaborate on joint and double degrees. Without any systemic policy constraints. We have the view that our immigration regulations currently are not favorable to international innovation. We receive stories on a daily basis, Chair, of professors being caught up in other countries, unable to come to our universities because of the stringent immigration regulations that have been introduced in the last few months. Our students also cannot go and do short courses in other parts of the world as recently as they used to, or as efficiently as they used to, because of the stringent immigration regulations. And we think there is a need for us to really have a conversation about giving some kind of dispensation for the university sector in relation to some of the provisions that immigration regulations make. We also think that for us to succeed, we need to create scholarships and other form of funding instruments to facilitate mobility of students outside our country, and also to attract students into our own system. So a diverse set of instruments, of scholarships, of bursaries, and so on, should be developed to attract students, to encourage students to go out, but also to attract students into our system. There should be dedicated funding sources to foster joint research collaboration between our academics and their counterparts in other parts of the world. A key issue that the department has also been working on is this internationalization policy framework for the university sector. We think time is right now for us to fast track the finalization of that policy framework, which will really provide a basis for a much more structured, coordinated internationalization efforts of our universities, including, amongst other things, possibly create funding instruments to facilitate international collaboration. A big issue that we still need to sort out, Honorable Chair, is the perennial challenge of coordination mechanisms across governments and between government departments. The DHET has got its own set of internationalization mechanisms, scholarships, bursaries, and so on. The DST also has its own. Department of International Relations and Cooperation also, from time to time, facilitates engagement between our countries and other countries in other parts of the world. And through the new agency that we have established called SAFDA, South African Partnership for Development Agency, we think there is a scope for us to benefit from the agency's interactions with other countries if it were to prioritize the funding of students and the funding of joint research collaboration as an issue. And we also think that home affairs should be brought to brought into the loop so that whatever policy instrument that they come up with shouldn't be at odds with what we want to achieve through internationalization efforts. Now, in terms of research, well, I just put up a slide here that gives us a sense of why is research so important for our country. And I've given examples, I don't want to go into that, I've given examples that suggest that our universities are engaged in a wide range of research activities to contribute to the national development imperatives and to help resolve the national development challenges that our country is facing. In the area of water, we've got quite a number of examples that we can cite in which our universities are involved in improvement of waste and water management. In the area of energy, rural and agricultural development and food security. In the area of health, and also in the area, in the emerging area of urbanization and its resulted implications for the development of our country. So research is very important for us to for it to be adequately funded so that our investors can continue to contribute to the development of our country. There are some highlights that I think I'm going to skip this slide. I think the highlights suggest that our investors system has been performing quite above its it's been punching above its weight, and some of the highlights are reflected there. We are producing the bulk of scientific research in Africa, and our research output has been on the increase in the last few years. Again, the slide shows the increase in research output from 2008 to 2012, around 2008 and 2010. like when I come to the next few slides. Now, in terms of research funding, the point we're making is that there has been a decline in funding for research and innovation in our system. We've raised that matter. Even, by the way, the Ministerial Committee on the Review of Funding for Universities has also agreed that there is indeed a decline in funding for research in our country. As the universities increase the research output unit, the total share to institution also decreases quite fundamentally. It's an issue that we would like to raise as well. As you can see, in 2012, we've seen an increase of about 10.5%, 2011, 26.8% growth, and so on. But as more and more universities start performing better in terms of research outputs, because there's only a certain amount of money available in the research funding envelope, then there is a decline in the total share to institution as a result of that. The same applies to progress that has been made in relation to doctoral graduate output. As universities increase their doctoral graduate output, again, that increase will have a similar effect in terms of the total share that goes to institutions decreasing. But again, the performance of the system in relation to doctoral graduate outputs, research outputs, and so on, puts pressure on research infrastructure funding, because now we need more equipment, research equipment, to be able to deal with the demand, more library collections and other related matters, which does not seem to match the current demand if we were to expand the system of our education. Again, the slide shows enrollments, the doctoral enrollments by race between 1996 and 2012. As you can see, Africans have been enrolling in large numbers to doctoral degrees. The 2012 figure currently sits around 6,700 students, followed by white South Africans, Indian and colored South Africans. And this is just a schematic representation of growth in the last few years of doctoral enrollment by age between 1996 and 2012. However, that growth does not translate into graduate output. As you can see, in the last 7 years, between 2006, only 46% of the total students registered for doctorate ended up graduating. And we have a dropout rate of 54%, or some of those students did not complete at all. The issue is becoming even more serious as you go into racial categories. As you can see, Africans, the graduation rate currently sits at around 39% of that cohort of students, and 61% dropped out, or did not complete their doctorate at the time of completing this study. So it's a big issue that we need to look at carefully. If you look at international students down there, 47% of those do complete, and only about 53% did not complete or dropped out in the process. The slide just shows doctoral graduates according to nationality. Again, you can see, although we're producing total 1,800 graduates, from the 2013 unit data, if you zoom deeper into racial classification, you realize that South African white students seem to be doing well compared to South African Africa. If you take this slide together with the slide on enrollment that we presented before. I'll skip this one. I think it's just demonstrating PhD production in South Africa versus PhD production in a number of selected OECD countries between 2000 and 2001. We're not doing as well as we could compared to other countries in other parts of the world. That's the key message that I think we need. Here again, yes, we have improved research output, and the spike in 2008 that I referred to, there seems to be, yes, there were interventions from the department side in terms of the revision of the research output policy, which could be attributed to, which one could attribute to the spike that we are seeing, but there seems to be a correlation between a number of academics holding a PhD and the research output thereof. So the more academics you have with PhD, the better the picture becomes in relation to research output of academic staff. We acknowledge that there are constraints. Postgraduate student enrollment and output remain low relative to national development needs. Only 56% or so of our academic workforce hold a doctorate. Research performance of our universities remains uneven. 10 universities are producing the bulk of the research output. There are serious issues of blockages in undergraduate and postgraduate pipeline that we need to address. And as we grow, postgraduate supervision capacities remain limited. The issue that we have been harping on since this morning is that research and postgraduate education funding is inadequate. And transforming the social composition of the academic workforce, bringing black and women academics into the system, remains an issue. And there seems to be a broader issue that we need to address relating to the producing and retaining the next generation of academics. And there is an effort that we are working with the Department of Higher Education and Training on to try and produce and retain the next generation of academics. We think that, as he said, that conditions that are now okay for us to engage and analyze the implementation of the differentiation policy framework. And as he said, we have said that such a differentiated system should have a range of specialized research-intensive universities to largely undergraduate institutions with various levels of research focus and postgraduate niches at master's and doctoral level. We think that the funding instrument should recognize that for our system to address the diverse needs facing our country, we need to have specialized institutions, we need to have research-intensive institutions, and undergraduate institutions, and those should be funded adequately to perform their mandate, their given mandate. Because such a differentiated system, we hope, gives scope to the different missions and programs and capabilities of our universities, but also builds and recognize the strength, the distinctive strength of our universities, and their achievements in line with their locations and their development trajectories. So we should fund universities in accordance with their strength, in accordance with their capabilities, but also in accordance with their defined mandates. And we are proposing here some few solutions. One, we should develop and implement as urgently as possible a national state-funded program for the next generation of academics. We think that is key, and as I indicated, we are working closely with the department to finalize a program in that regard. But also create diverse funding instruments to support and retain postgraduate students at honors, masters, and doctoral level. Implement a differentiation policy, again giving each institution a clearly defined mandate that I assume will be negotiated with that institution. Increase funding allocation as a percentage of government budget and of GDP in line with the projected student enrollment growth. strengthen also university business collaboration and implement the long-awaited National Digital Library for Universities that the DST and the Department of Higher Education and Training have been working on for some time, to allow universities to access electronic material, scholarly material, to bulk buy electronic scholarly material in order for them to improve their research performance. We think digitalization, Honorable Chair, is important for the health of our system. We need to do a lot more to give effect to that. And we think our research innovation performance requires catalytic intervention, some of which I've already mentioned. And number four here, it is our considered view that an adequately funded higher education system would assist us to meet the projected student enrollment growth in the National Development Plan, in the White Paper on Post-School Education and Training, and other policy documents of the state. Thank you very much.
So, colleagues, thank you very much. I mean, it's a long presentation, as you can see. If you like, that there have been some successes over the last couple of years. I mean, you look at the number of students that have gone up at undergraduate level. You look at the level of research output increasing over the last 4 or 5 years. But, you know, what we are saying is that we are coming to the limits of the system. Our competitors around the world are offering more money in postgraduate students. They're putting more money in undergraduate students. And frankly, if as a system we do not come together, we could find ourselves in serious challenges, not only with the advanced developed economies in North America and Western Europe, but with our own, with our peers in many parts of the developing world. And it seems to me that there are four essential challenges. The first is subsidies are decreasing. You saw that graph, and really it's something that we should be very, very worried about. Even though student numbers are increasing, so students, we are spending far less. We have had, you'll see, and my Max has just brought it to my attention, in one of those graphs, you'll see that we've grown our system by 1,200 academics in the last 4 years. 800 of those academics are foreign. Only 400 are South African. That's, so two-thirds of the growth of the last 5 years in academic appointments partly has been foreign. And that doesn't do much for the transformation potential and all of the other challenges. Research productivity has gone up, but as I said, it's actually quite amazing that it's gone up given the fact that monies have been declining. And I do think efficiencies we've pushed quite heavily, restructurings we've pushed, but you're not going to do that. And we, in this moment, we have to do two things. We have to increase the numbers of undergraduate students. We also have to increase the numbers of postgraduate students and research applicants, because you're never going to retain the competitiveness of the South African economy if you don't do that. And you have to do that simultaneously. And there's only way two suggestions you're putting onto the table. The one is we're going to have to talk about money. I understand that we are competing priorities. We understand the challenges of the system. But we're going to have a very frank conversation on that. And the second is differentiation. If we all try to do the same thing, we're never going to be able to do this. And how we do that and how we win that collectively is something that we need to think about. So, you know, that's, if you like, the sum total of that long presentation. And we'd be happy to engage and have a more open conversation on these and any other related challenges, I would imagine, on the issues that we could address. I will end up by saying that I think we're going to have to structure, and the trick about all of this is going to be balance. We've got competing priorities, we've got conflicting challenges, we're going to have to figure out how to strike the right balance between these competing issues. And that's the big challenge there. So, Chair, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to articulate our issue and our perspective on this.
Deputy Chair, you are covered. All right. Thank you very much for the presentation. It was an insightful and an eye-opener, and I'm sure it has actually assisted us after reading to even understand the content of the presentation better. Before I ask the committee to engage in a discussion on the presentation, I would like to ask the Department of Higher Education and Training just to respond on or brief us on the policy and the regulatory environment, because I have here somebody who is on the policy section of the department. Just to give us information so that we know exactly what's happening, and you, as you present, you'll then be responding to the issues raised in this presentation. Thank you, sir. Over to you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. The two issues really. That's the policy on internationalization, with also policy on joint degrees. But to state first that we are not in favor of double degrees, but in favor of joint degrees. And therefore, the work that we are doing on the policy development is on the joint degrees. We set up a committee last year to assist us, and that comprises colleagues from the sector, from the university, to assist us with the development of that policy. They had promised a report last month, and I think we are in the closing stages of that report, and therefore, you know, the development of that policy. And then the second element, that policy on joint degrees will form part of the broader policy framework on internationalization. So that work, that sub component of it, which is joint degrees, is heading for completion, at least in terms of the draft. And then the policy framework on internationalization, we are in the early stages there. We are soliciting assistance from the EU, who are advanced in as far as policy is concerned on internationalization, and of course also they are assisting us financially. We have had a meeting already in July where they committed and we've developed a proposal which again we have reworked after they have commented, and I think around the 18th of September they will be taking a decision on the funding of that process and also putting in their experts to assist us, and of course again working with our own experts and therefore also consultation with the system. So by the, our target is that by the end of our financial year we should be having a draft framework through that assistance. At the moment that will be all that I'll be giving input on, and then the rest I would be able to respond certainly on the questions that are put to the department. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. All right. Can you just briefly touch on the differentiation policy, which is also outstanding, and then from there we then hand over to.
Okay.
If you can please speak through the mic, we can hear from this end.
Thank you very much. We will do so.
Okay. Thanks, ma'am. On differentiation, actually there was a draft already before we even launched the white paper for post-school education and training, and that aspect of differentiation is covered there also in the white paper for post-school education. So now what we are left with is to do the consultation process on the draft that we are having throughout the sector. In fact, that is how we do policemen. the consultation so that the policy has got the support of the sector. Now, I won't be able to give dates to when is that consultation going to be taking place and the completion of the policy without consulting back the colleague who's driving that process. But at least we have a draft already, and what is remaining is to do that consultation process and therefore complete the policy on differentiation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your response. I will now open for clarity seeking questions, but because the people will be leaving earlier, I will then say let's combine both clarity seeking questions and a discussion on the presentation. Professor Pozzoli, Ms. Killian, Mr. Mata, Mr. Kasim, and Ms. Ntulu, and then Mr. Keka, in that order.
Thanks for an interesting presentation. You've raised many important questions. Insufficient funding overall, which is quite shocking. The need for internationalization blockages to be unblocked, which would require interdepartmental effort, I presume. The peculiar system of research output funding, where you get less research money the more you produce. And differentiation. Now, what I want to know is, does the department take your advice in any of these questions? How influential is HESA? I've looked at many of your reports, which are often absolutely excellent, but I do worry whether they go anywhere and whether HESA isn't perhaps a little bit toothless. And then the second point is, when you look at the decline in funding, which I agree, of course, is a huge issue. But do your figures include NRS funding when you show how sports universities have declined? Because I think if you don't include NRS funding, you would be presumably subject to some sort of criticism for not looking at it overall. They will still show as declining, but I think it's an important aspect. Then when it comes to the kinds of funding that university gets, does HESA have a view on DST and DOHEC both funding higher education in research? So you've got DST funding the NRS, which then funds research of a specific sort, and then you've got DOHEC funding research output figures in this peculiar, perverse, incentive kind of manner. Now, is that an effective system, and does it allow DOHEC to disguise the very low figure of research funding that actually comes from the department itself? My sense is that it does, and when I asked the minister about it at a workshop we had a couple of weeks ago, whenever you criticize DOHEC for low research funding, he says, well, the DST is doing that. But if you add the two figures together, I'm not sure whether we are in any ballpark internationally for the level of research funding that we get. I don't know if you get the point I'm trying to make, really obscurely. And then the last point is this differentiation point. Again, I have looked at the HESA document 2012 on differentiation vision. And when I asked the minister about it, he said, well, the universities can't agree on this, so therefore it's going to stall. So I wonder again, does this show that HESA can't quite get what it wants on the departmental agenda? What is the departmental differentiation policy going to look like? And how serious will it be? Will it be properly funded? Will it entail a change of the funding formula to adapt to differential missions? Now, you can't answer for the department, but I think what you can answer for is whether HESA is taken seriously enough for your own satisfaction. Because otherwise it can become simply a talk shop. Thank you.
Well, I would like the department to also prepare itself to respond on this issue that is raised by Professor. And then whilst he is, I will also add. All right. Thank you very much. Next. Ms. Killian.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, thank you very much. It is indeed a very interesting presentation. Can I just start by asking, Honourable Zoli has asked a question about NRF funding and whether that was included. I'm actually now also referring to that particular slide, slide 4. And if you could perhaps just indicate, you're speaking of third stream. Is that where you also have the benefits of reserves that some universities have, that you can actually contribute? And do you have any knowledge of reserves kept by some of the institutions? Because obviously, it's not as though we would like to count on the reserves. It's just an indication of which of the institutions can better manage shortfalls in budget allocations. So I would like to know if you're aware of that. Then secondly, the percentage of GDP is obviously a very telling slide. Now, does this incorporate NRF funding in everything that comes from the national fiscus as a percentage, or is it only this specific department and its as subsidies? I would like to know more about that. Then, what is also obviously a critical area is academics. And can I say homegrown academics? It is very interesting that there has been quite a significant PhD growth of foreign students. Now, obviously, if some people are cynical about it, they could say postgraduate students and the benefits because of the awarding, although it takes very long, I must say. If you look at this, it's a seven-year period. It takes very long before institutions can actually benefit from the PhDs awarded financially. Now, just a question. Foreign students, do they come with bursaries from their countries, and is it therefore beneficial for our institutions to rather put them through? And I think it's very obvious that it's difficult because you do not have adequate master and specifically PhD academics to supervise PhD and master students. So that's it's sort of a chicken and egg situation. But what intervention does ESA believe we can make to actually increase the number of successful black professors? You know, what can we do in this country? Homegrown professors, yes, it's good. Internationalization, there's nothing wrong. And then, Chair, I note that ESA refers to other countries in terms of internationalization. Could you perhaps just mention the countries where they have 15 to 30%? Is it necessary for us to go there? If we look at the pressures on our system, we can certainly see the benefits. We're not indicating in any way that we shouldn't, move ahead with the current balance. But is it necessary to increase it, and for what reason? Then just as a matter of interest, the alumni records, is that available of the institution? Do we really know, do we have a tracking mechanism to know our students who have studied? Because for a particular reason, and I think we can look at the socioeconomic conditions in South Africa, it is difficult for students who have obtained some other degree to be retained as academics in the system, because they have to also look at the other siblings at home, etc. They must go into a work as soon as possible. And that possibly explains the 7-year period. But do you have any records of those foreign students? Do they come to South Africa in our economy, or do they go back into their country? What do we know about them?
I think with that, I would like to conclude. I would have loved to ask a question about research funding, but I think I will leave that to my colleagues. Thank you.
What guarantee do you have that they will ask the same question on this debate? Can you please give us a question, but be short and to the point so that you save time. Thank you very much. Ms. Killian, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I must say I was quite perturbed when I read on, and the presentation said on page 20, that it is this very awkward ratio. Now, I think we just need to understand, because I really did not understand that to be...
Which one is that?
That is slide 20. The research output versus the total share that the institution has done. If we could just get a better understanding. So therefore, you say that we are actually penalizing research output.
Thank you very much for the questions. And next, Ms. Mbatase.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Also, two comments and then one question. The first comment is, by the way, thank you very much for your presentation, Jacob. My first comment is, I think we have a system that is really, really not going to survive its own journey. Firstly, because it's bleeding from all sectors of itself. I'll just make one example. For universities of technology to increase the number of junior lecturers in the system, it requires extraordinary investment by the state on beaches, because you have to begin somewhere. And the majority of those who will be attracted, in particular African graduates, will be attracted to continue from junior diploma degree, joining BTEC. They get stuck because of funding. The universities can no longer release its own amount all the time. And also a majority of these universities of technology will not historically have the latitude of donors and organizations that can finance that. So, Honorable Chair, even when you will have had in one instance of one university to the other, extremely talented young African women who would have loved to get into specialized industries, our system will actually chase them out unless the university vice chancellor intervenes through redirecting some bursary to the youngster. And then you go to the master's, the same thing. We only fund up until a junior degree through NSFAS. So, in real form, is that the very same African youngsters that you want to target to be your future as junior lecturers and senior lecturers, you are actually rejecting them as soon as they start thinking about that, through your own instruments and your own support system. That's one. Two, so I will really support the idea of a re-engineered state-funded way in which we target maybe out of the 10 that are currently the most contributing to research, we also target an additional 12 and say, what is it that we can do to inject support and to make sure that support targets young women, young Africans in particular, into the system. I attended the graduation ceremony in April of one of the universities here in Cape Town, University of Technology here in Cape Town. What they are referring to, Chair, as people who graduate in PhD and Masters, actually came here in Zimbabwe. I said in 4 graduation ceremonies, more than 6,000 young men and women passed through in night and day. The PhDs were given to Kenyans and Zimbabweans. There was not even a single South African. And by the way, Honorable Chair, they were not young. They were people who have been working in those countries, who have been sent by employers. The only ones who were young, they were Namibians, but they were much more on masters. But also, they came through the ranks, which means they started as a junior and then they went into the masters, financed by their own government. We don't have that. Now,
so what's your proposal?
My proposal is that we engineer that and we table that to the minister. It cannot be that we cannot have this. In particular for those depressed universities of technology who cannot even raise a single donor financing for this. You have to have a targeted effort. If, for instance, out of so many, we say we will start with the 10. We spread the amount. We target BTEC, Masters, and PhD. And then we say we want to look at the picture after 5 years. If we don't do anything now, we will be talking about this in 2019 as the new committee of 2014. Because that's how things work if you don't act.
Okay, let's be positive.
I'm trying to. I'm going to be more
positive
now.
I
love your, in conclusion, I love your point number 2. It looks so much as one of the sentences from the ruling party. Thank you, Chair.
On which slide?
In conclusion, point number 2.
You know that I have asked.
It says, despite the gains made since 1994. But if you look at the bleeding of the system, it has been crumbling constantly.
You
and
know
it sounds
that
like one of those that you normally say in your manifesto. I'm joking. But we have to act now, Chair.
Okay, are you done now?
I'm done, Chair. Thank you.
I just don't like the statement where you referred us back to the ruling parties, whatever. Let's be honest. Let's rise above and focus on the real issues that will take the education in South Africa to greater heights. Just rise a little bit above politics, because once we go into that era, you know, and I don't want to quote EFF, but you know what will happen. I was going to light a note, okay? No, that's fine. Thank you very much for your contribution, and Mr. Mbatha, very constructive, and we are really benefiting from your experience. Come again? All right. As the chairperson, can I make a ruling? This was a positive contribution, and let's keep up the good work. All right. Okay. Next. Yourself, Mr. Kaffin.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've been captured by most of the speakers. I'm not going to repeat those things. I just want to ask a few questions then that I've been left with. The first question is linked to what Ms. Mbatha was saying around the funding options that students do have. Now, I want to just frame it very, very quickly. You spoke about the BTEC options, and we know the issues around that, but I want to talk about some honours degrees that do not have research as a component. BCom Honours is an example of that, which has prevented some universities' bursaries departments from funding them, as well as master's qualifications that has a year of coursework or 2 years of coursework without a research component. Now, what we have been told in the past is that those students cannot be funded because there has to be a certain percentage of the year that must be research. And that's this, I'm not sure whether it's at specific institutions or whether this is more widespread, but this is the bursary departments or scholarships and bursary departments that have said this. And master's itself doesn't cover it because it will only cover until the first degree. So I just want something around that, but also more wider, clarity around the different funding options, particularly those from previously disadvantaged backgrounds, and how they are able to access postgraduate studies. I then want to ask around the SADC students that we have. Now, there was a SADC resolution, I think as far back as 2001, that spoke about the fees that those in SADC countries must pay at the different institutions being the same as a local student. Now, I know for a fact that this isn't something that's practiced at some universities. The fees that they are required to pay is massive, three times or four times what a local student pays. And it's actually, in some instances, run through separate departments, and you pay it, your admissions through separate departments. And it has really cut off the type of access that these students have. So I imagine there's a reason behind that resolution in the first place. I just want to want an answer around, whether that is being implemented, what is ESA's view around that, and what is your affiliates saying around that and the implementation. Then around the question of students from other countries that want to be able to study. Now, I just want to know, in ESA's experience, have they had problems with Home Affairs in particular, the Department of Home Affairs, where you have students that have applied for refugee status? And I'm talking to students from Somalia and other areas. I've had many that have contacted myself as well that have had issues with getting status in this country and having access to be able to study or their studies. Just some sort of clarity around that. And then finally, just in the graphs, speaking about the progress of the doctoral entrance in 2006, what is ESA's view as the reasons behind the 46% progress rate? What are the contributors? What are the causal factors behind that? Has it got to do with the support that has been received by those particular individuals, or is it something else? And what is the reason in the following graph that, particularly what is referred to as South African on the graph at 16.9% doing not as well as the white South Africans in that category? Are there socioeconomic factors? And what can be done about that to make sure that students, if that is the case, can receive the type of support that they need to succeed, so that whatever investment is being put in is not in vain? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for your contribution. Next.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. My question is on the NEET. I don't know whether you call it that, the NEET. I think we all agree that the number is alarmingly high, and believe that the stats have been shared with the Department of Education, Higher Education. I would like to know what is the departmental plan with regards to the NEET.
NEET.
Yeah. I got your abbreviation. The second one is on
too many of these abbreviations. That's fine.
The second one is on the graph, which the graph on expenditure on higher education, which depicts South Africa as spending little on higher education. I am realizing that the comparison is with different sets of countries if you're looking at the socio-economic conditions. I would like you to just give me an explanation on how South Africa is doing when compared with other countries, the BRICS. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, it's your turn, Mr. Kekana. Thank you, ma'am. Thanks for your contribution.
Chair, thanks very much.
Sapele re ba tambogela Mr. Mabelebele, tobela Mr. Mabelebele. Okay. My teacher's primary was Mabelebele, so the name is very special to me. Yeah. The first point on immigration. Presently in the presidency, there's an immigration law that has been looked at to be change or relax so that it allows, this was in particular reference to math and science teachers from overseas. That immigration law, which the president is looking at and changing, should make it more easier for math and science teachers to immigrate to South Africa for the first 7 years. And maybe while that is the case, now that you've raised the issue of our students and academics being locked up or kind of meeting obstacles or moving around to our country, while they are looking at that immigration law for math and science students, you can just say, would add this point that you've added that for academics and students, the immigration law should cover that. After you've left, I'm sure the committee will discuss further and see if we can invite Home Affairs, have a joint meeting and invite you so that we all influence them to speed up the process with the president. That's the first comment. The second one, on the money, you know, as we all are aware, money is not an easy thing to come by for anybody. And I know this is a big problem in our area because, like, we know we're hoping universities will take us our education out of poverty, which means, indeed, if we want to fight poverty, this is supposed to be the instrument we can use instead wealth in our country to move out of poverty. But my own advice would be, you know, when you get students going to university and 10% of those students are unemployed, this actually shooting us in the foot, because this was the only real hope when we were growing up. If we graduate, we're such a big thing. In my street, grannies would even take grammar stuff to you when they are blocked, because often he can help us. So there was so much hope in any graduate from university. If you're a big DA, you're a big thing in the world, in my world. So I'm just saying, universities, while you're teaching, please make sure that you graduate through campaigns, through these guys that you are educating who ultimately become human resource officers or managers. They employ people, because if that doesn't happen, to be honest, in our society, it shoots us in the foot to see he's a graduate, he's just like me, who am illiterate, he's unemployed. He's basking in the sun during the day with all his degree. It's really, I think that is the one area. The other area is part of the research, and this is the last point, part of the research that we do, I mean, I personally, for the issue of solar system, you know, the way we do things, we do them just because we are copycats of first world countries. Even when conditioner means Africa has sunshine, why haven't we started researching on how to use solar system, the sun, to generate energy in South Africa in particular? I know University of Rau and Stellenbosch are starting that now. But the point I'm making is that I wish that the research that we do can not just be seen to be mental gymnastics at university, but something that really benefits society. At times, the research that is done at university, for a layman in the street, he doesn't see how it benefits him directly. So I'm just saying interaction with government. So the part of the, I mean, there's so much to be done as research that could benefit our society. But part of what it is done, we know so exactly where it goes, who it benefits. And I'm just requesting that you'll get more money
if you could show a big impact of your research directly into the society, which is not happening. People are producing cars, small countries like Korea, they are producing on there. Why can't we do it ourselves? Though we have 26 universities. So I'm just saying the relationship and direct impact of research on society will automatically encourage the society to give you more money. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kekana, for your contribution. I will now allow KISA and the department to respond to the issues raised by the committee the honorable committee members. Let's start with the department.
Thank you very much, ma'am. A few questions. The question on the research funding from the department. You know, I wish we can have more time on this one, man, because it's got more information than presented. But the department is funding in the current year, 2014-15, the department is putting in 2,770,000,000 rand, 101. To research, and that is 14% of the budget that goes to the universities. It's a large percentage of the total budget to the institutions. I think the issue may be that the budget is not enough, and not necessarily that the department is not funding research enough, but the total budget to the institutions is not enough.
Does that include students?
Sorry, ma'am.
Is most of that not funding PhD and MA students?
That amount includes research masters, graduates, not the students who are enrolled, and PhDs, graduates again. Those are the outputs of research.
Okay.
Now,
if I may come in. Let's allow the responses. I will then allow honorable members follow-up questions. Just note the follow-up questions so that he can then respond. I mean, yeah, and flow in his response without being interrupted. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, let me just indicate that that is going to increase to 3 billion and 15,000,000.169 rand in 2015-2016. Again, 14.4% that increase. Yes, it funds research masters, not taught masters, there's a difference, and also PhD graduates. Now, almost 60% of that amount, so can you do your quick calculation on that one, almost 60% of that 2 billion rand that I'm referring to in the current financial year goes to the research intensive institutions. And the research intensive institutions plus minus six, but strictly speaking, we count five. Now six is the Rhodes University, and but Rhodes University is a very small university, and so you know that's why I say plus minus five. And the five are UCT, Wits University, both of them represented here today, and University of Pretoria, UKZN, and Stellenbosch University, and then including then Rhodes University, as I've indicated. So the bulk of that 2 billion rand goes to those institutions. Then we do have research development grants that we use to assist the institutions that are struggling with research. I guess, you know, if the issue is about the formula that is perverse, I would agree definitely on that one, ma'am, because it benefits the few and a large number of institutions are not necessarily benefiting. So that's why then we use the research development grant. And with that research development grant,
grants of 187 million rand at the moment in the current financial year. The large bulk of that amount goes to the historically disadvantaged institutions. It's a small amount. It's not big, but at least we think that it will make a huge difference in the sector, in the form of research development at the institution. The formula we're using, just a quick reference, it's a similar formula that is used in the UK and a similar formula used in Australia. I'm sure there are other countries. We have been speaking to the Norwegians where they use the same formula, and Finland, Sweden, similar formula. So it's not necessarily something that as South Africans, you know, we are unique in applying that formula. The slight difference that we have with UK is that in UK, in South Africa, the institutions submit their research outputs annually. But in UK, they do that every 5 years, and then, you know, then you allocated funding over the next 5 years, and then they do the evaluation again, and they would do the adjustments if, for instance, you've grown too big during the past 5 years, or you've shrunk, whatever the case is. So they would do those adjustments. That's the slight difference that we're having. If you can, Chair, Dr. Mangalevele, if you can go to slide 24. I'm trying to answer the question here, that slide. The one before that. The next one. This one. I'm trying to answer the question here about the graduates, postgraduates or PhD graduates that are mainly from the outside the country. Now, that slide says something different to that. It's quite faint, but the red bar that is the first one to your left, that is South African total of doctoral graduates. If you look at the top there, that's doctoral graduates according to nationality as percent of total doctoral graduates, 2012. Now, the red bar, that is to the left one, is the South African total. So it says something completely different to the perceptions that are out there, that the system is graduating more foreign students than local students. That is 66.5% being South African as a total in that year. And then the rest would be from different parts of the continent. Yes, it is true that we do hold quite a large number of foreign nationals in our system, plus minus 17,000 students currently, and some of them at all levels. Let me put it like that, at all levels, undergrad and postgrad. I think that one, I think I've answered that one, ma'am. Then the SADC protocol, yes, it's correct, it's there, it was signed in 1999. We are, in terms of the protocol, we're compelled to have a minimum of 5% of our enrollment being from the region, from SADC. Well, currently we are having 7.5% of our total enrollment being foreign, not necessarily SADC, and the SADC would be about close to 6% of that. So there is a large number of students coming from the SADC region. In certain instances, we are having more students in South Africa than the host countries the countries of origin, and the examples here, quite a number of them, Lesotho, Swaziland, Botswana, we're hosting more students than they have back at home. In the recent count, we're having about 23,000 Zimbabweans in the system, and you can put that into perspective. Many of our institutions don't have enrollment of 23,000 students. So if you can put the Zimbabweans into one institution, you can have them constituting one of our good large number of students. Now, the rest of fees, in terms of the fee payment, I think I'll hand that one to Hisa to answer. But yes, we've got that obligation. I wanted to confirm that we've got an obligation to charge the fees from the SADC students, the same fees that we are charging for local students. But then there may be differences in terms of the levies there. But that will be answered by the by colleagues from GISA. Then the plan on the NEET, not in education, not in employment, and not in training. It's actually more than the number that was shown there. So it's quite scarier than HISA has shown us. HISA has shown us 2 point something million. It's grown. It's growing, and it's really worrying. The plan that the department has is mainly through the skills program that we are having, the CFAS. Channeling those numbers of students to the CCAS currently. But as you may have heard from Dr. Mabelebele when he was presenting, the growing sector called community colleges. That is, again, the target in terms of the plan. That's the target to have that need to be channeled to the community colleges sector. Well, indeed, it's not to say that they are not welcome. For instance, in the existing TVET and the universities sectors, certainly, and the large number of the students now, the growing number of students in the system, are students that are dependent on NSFAS, and that's an indication of the socio-economic background, particularly economic background of those students, and the more the dependence is on NSFAS, and as you could see also in the three streams, the more the growth of the fees in those graphs, those ones, the middle section, quite faint on the screen, the more the debt also is rising. The students who are unable to pay at the institutions, and therefore, you know, we cannot say that we are dealing decisively with the needs. There is a problem of the needs growing, as much as the interventions that are being made are also trying to catch as many students as possible. But there is that problem. So what I'm trying to say here is that. The solution for the needs does not only rely on the Department of Higher Education and Training with its limited interventions, but it's a broader societal issue that has to be solved by the society. It's a good reflection of the state of poverty in our country, and also it's a good reflection of the state of unemployment in our system. Because some of those needs are graduates, some of them have got the skills, but it's just that they are not employed and they are not having their own businesses, they are unable to do that. So it's a broader problem than the solution that the department is providing. But that is the plan that the department is providing. Then I think I've covered the questions that were direct to the department.
Okay. Well, thank you for those responses. Just want to check on my list here if there's anything that you've left out. You see, I think you've left out some your comment on the National Digital Library for universities. We need you to comment on that one. But also, where I think the honourable member spoke about fees for foreign students, which were abnormally high, and I would want your response on that one. Maybe also just educating us about your SADC protocol when it comes to these matters. And right. Well, you spoke about because there was a serious issue raised on the decline in research funding. You spoke about that and you responded to that one. But also in research in our country, people respond to that one. There's funding, there's research, but there's also research infrastructure funding. Or is this included in the research funding? The research infrastructure funding. Yeah. If you can, all right. Also, if you can also respond on government's plan to produce more South African PhD graduates. That's us. The foreign graduates, if I put it correctly, this is English. Prof. The foreign graduates.
Yeah.
If you can just respond to that one, and then we then allow to come on board.
Thank you very much, ma'am. National Digital Library.
Thank you. Yes, I missed out on that one. We yes, it's correct. The department is working closely with the Department of Science and Technology through its through ASAS, ASAS, the acronym. You know, colleagues will help me there. I'm just going to blame my own ASAS. The study has been completed. We also looked at some countries that are making use of the National Digital Library. Brazil is a good example that is good and introduced the National Digital Library not long ago, and they've managed also through their program to up the number of PhD outputs. Contributing into their research outputs. So that study was completed. The report was completed. What is remaining is to then do the consultative process with the institutions, and also to model it in terms of what would it mean in terms of funding, and also where are we going to be getting that funding. The options are there. Option one would be to take that funding from the current allocation that is given to the institutions, and because they are paying the individual licenses for access to digital libraries, and maybe pool it together and have a one source of funding, then that government can then go and use it and buy the national license at a cheaper price than what the institutions are currently spending on. The other option, which seems very, very faint at the moment, would be to get money from the fiscal national treasury. That one is very, very faint. But anyway, these options will go together with the consultative process to the system, so that we have a better advice and also the support of the system, the higher education system in the digital library. What it basically means, it's a good thing really to have. What it means is that because some institutions are unable to afford access to these licenses because of money, they are limited therefore in their access to information. So what it would mean is that once it's a national one, then we would be able to make the access to information available equally throughout the system, all the institutions to have the same access to the information without others having more access and the others less. So that's how good it is. And I think I'm summarizing it there. It's called the annual nuances, but that's the essence of it.
Okay.
Then on the fees for foreign students, ma'am, that is the element that I said the colleagues from ISA would answer the question about the protocol, the SADC protocol,
okay.
Which compels us, one, to have
yes, we did some survey not long ago, but you know, I'm deliberately leaving it to the sector to answer. Research infrastructure, our funding of research infrastructure. We've got funding of research infrastructure that is set aside, and there are certain different categories in that in the funding of infrastructure. It could be, for instance, the infrastructure for research, infrastructure student residences, infrastructure on African languages, and so on and so on. So different categories. So the institutions submit applications to get access to that money. So they submit their plans, and then therefore they are then allocated funding according to what is then approved by the department and what can be funded for. So it's part of the infrastructure funding. It's not necessarily a completely standalone separate amount that then goes to funding of the research infrastructure. Production of more graduates, PhD graduates, what the plan the department is having. I referred to the 187 million rand that we set aside to fund research development in the system. And one of the main portion of that money goes to the funding of academics to improve their qualifications. There was one slide here that was shown that the correlation between research output and the qualifications the academics have, PhDs, that the academics have. So the more PhDs you have, the more research you produce. As simple as that. And also the 60% I was talking about of that funding, of research funding being generated, almost 60% being going to the five research intensive institutions. And it's similar also when you look at the PhD qualifications. A large number of academics with PhDs are at those research intensive institutions in the system. So that's the correlation, and it goes on and on and on, those correlations. You can then read all the others that follow. But the end result is that more research outputs from the research intensive institutions, and hence they are known as research intensive institutions, more PhDs that they produce, more academics with PhDs, more money, and so on, and so on. So the research development grants, therefore, we are then trying to say to the institutions, which large portion of that money, by the way, man, it goes to the historically disadvantaged institutions. So we're compelling them to use that money to improve the qualifications of the academics. All the institutions have got access to research development. So what we say to the research intensive institutions is that you've got access to the research development grant, but what we would want to see from them is to improve the demographics, their demographics, and also to contribute to the sector to improve the demographics of the sector. So yes, it's correct that there are still far less black academics in the system, especially with high qualifications. So therefore, we request the research-intensive institutions to make a contribution to the improvement of that statistics through the research development grant. And of course, we also encourage collaborations between the research-intensive, the medium, if you like, medium intensive, and the less research intensive institution, to have a collaboration throughout there, so that we can correct the system in terms of its demographic complexion of their academics. Ma'am, I think I have again covered those questions.
Thank you very much for your responses. I will now hand over to Professor Khatib to respond to the remaining issues.
The way I'm going to suggest we do this is I'm going to make and respond to one or two issues.
and then I'm going to open up to my colleagues, and they can respond to what they've identified. And then what I hope to do is come back and see whatever questions that have not been answered out of my pocket. I think perhaps I should start off by saying that, you know, when I'm here, obviously I'm the Vice Chancellor of Wits, and Max is the Vice Chancellor of UCT. But when we're here, we speak for the system. And we speak for our colleagues in the historically black universities and all of the other complexities. So, and when I speak here, I speak of a collective mandate that exists in the system and some of the issues. Now, I say this because it's important to start clarifying where we are and what we're standing with. Is it true that there are differences in the system? Obviously, there are. It would be crazy to imagine all 25 vice chancellors exactly carrying the same position on every question. But there is a set of systemic consensus that has emerged on a number of issues, and we all agree with that. And where these differences, I'll tell you what the differences are and what the debates are, because I think we collectively need to start thinking this. I want to start with the esteemed member's question around whether he says the truthless body. Because I think it's an important question to have. And I think it's an important question to say, that, look, is it true that everything we raise is taken by the Department of Higher Education and Training? Obviously not. We know that that's not the case. The question is, however, I don't think that that's the fault only of the Department of Higher Education and Training. I think we are in a position where, and he has had a conversation at this at his latest expo, or at his last board meeting, is about what do we need to do as HESA to start ensuring that our conversations are heard by the powers that be? And what is it that we have to change in the way that we practice our advocacy so that we are beginning to engage in this? I must say, I do think that we are fast approaching a point where unless we come as a collective, across the parties, but more importantly, across departments, across HESA, across sector, to start saying, excuse me, what are the challenges and how do we understand how to make choices around these challenges? It's going to involve trade-offs. Our problem in the system, and by the way, in multiple other areas, is we give a little bit of money for everything. And then at the end, we never invest enough critical mass on the substantive issues, so we're never able to resolve our problems. And so I think if we're going to start investing sufficiently in critical mass, we're going to have to make hard choices. We're going to have to say some issues that we're going to have to postpone for 5 years down the line because we're going to put and invest in certain issues now so that we can create the collective resource. Now that's a hard choice because you're going to say to some people and to say to some very critical areas, we're going to underfund you now so we can adequately fund somebody else. And we'll come back to you in 3 years. That's a hard choice. And that choice needs to be made by us collectively. And it has to transcend the party and institutional boundaries. And for me, I think that that's absolutely fundamental. If we have this conversation where an esteemed member says one thing, the department responds and says, well, that's not our problem, that's HESA's problem, or HESA says, that's not our problem, that's the department's problem, we lost this game. It's not going to work. We're all going to lose in 5 or 6 years, and I think the team member was right. We're not tackling the real problems in our system. We make some gains. But the real challenges are seriously this thing. We're underfunding, not only compared to the Americans or the Europeans, we're underfunding compared in proportional terms to our African peers. We're underfunding in relation to every single big country at the moment. And we are heading for a contextual disaster. So I wanted to start off by saying that I think that that's, are we adequately, are what we're saying being heard? I think that it's not being heard, but I think that the problem is not simply a single department or a single individual. I think we're going to have to start thinking through a conversation. And I was going to make a suggestion, but there's a real urgent need, I think, for not a conversation of a portfolio committee on higher education. I'd love to bring the Vice Chancellors to a conversation of a Portfolio Committee in Higher Education, the Portfolio Committee on GST, and the Portfolio Committee on Trade in the same room having this conversation on subsequent. Because we can't have that conversation if treasury is not sitting in the room. And so I think that there's an urgent need to have a cross-portfolio conversation on funding and the hard trade-offs that need to be understood in it. So that's the first point I wanted to make. The second is the issue of differentiation. There's differences in the system. And the problem is until now the system has been governed by our history. And that history is as follows. There were a number of historically black universities that were not allowed to be what they wanted to be because they were restricted by the apartheid laws. In a democratic era, they now have the freedom to be what they want to be. But to get to what they want to be, because UCT or BRICS has been a product, not of subsidism, it's a product of 100-year history. And so the question has become a fight, if you like, bearing in mind our history, between who gets the adequate resources to be what. But I'll tell you this, if you give as money, if we could find the money and give all of the universities the same access, more cash, and let's say a Venda or a Limpopo were to become BRICS or UCC, the system is in trouble. Because the dilemma of our society is we have to produce multiple skills. We need first degree professionals. We need vocational and technical skills, as you suggested. We need masters and PhDs. And in a competitive world, we need to produce all of them at the same time. To do so, we're going to have to differentiate. But the problem about our differentiation is our differentiation is status-driven. It's defined. So research institutions are seen as status, what a level of status the other institutions are not. And the problem is that if we think this through as institutions, we're in trouble and we're heading for a disaster. So what we have to do in that collective conversation when you bring the Vice Chancellor and you bring the Department of Higher Education and Training and DST and Treasury, and say collectively, as a country, what skills are required? How do we produce those skills and which institutions are going to mix and mash and achieve those skills and what are the resources required for them? That's the conversation. And now we've got, I don't know, 50 billion or 60 billion or 70 billion. How do we make the hard choices to make sure that mandate is full in those institutions? Do I want to ensure that the historically black universities are given more money? Absolutely. That's my mandate. Do I want to see that they're given more mandate from the research development grant? Absolutely. But if we do that and we have that conversation and we don't have the collective conversation as a system, what is it, the collective, the number of skills we need and how are we going to produce that and how are we going to make the hard choices, we're in trouble. And this is the danger with this system. We can produce as much research as you want. If you don't address those 2.9 million, they're at the moment, I think, Chief, at 4 million. Those 4 million people, you can bet the public, produce the greatest PhDs you want. If we don't figure out a mechanism to resolve that, those 4 million people are going to burn the society down. And then all of the PhDs will be jumping on a ship and a plane and running for another country anyway. So it would have been a fruitless expenditure, if you like. The trick is, how do we think through as a system? And for me, that's the singular biggest challenge. So I want to end at one point. I do think we need a collective conversation. And I think we need a collective conversation here. But we need a collective conversation that brings Treasury around the table, DST, the Vice Chancellors, maybe other players outside, other stakeholders. And we need to learn to make hard choices. The second thing, colleagues, we need is we need to decide quickly. And once we've made the decisions quickly, we need to implement it. And I say this because the National Digital Library is not a departmental. The National Digital Library, the conversation started in 2006. This is a mechanism that can save us money, and not only will it save us money in one single parcel, but we'll save money and we'll equalize access to quality information in the country. And it's taken us 8 years to get to the point of consultation. If we don't learn to move the system quick, we are in trouble. And for me, that's the problem of the National Digital Library. We all agree it's a fantastic idea. But we
had an agreement in 2006, we did the studies, we looked at the listing. 2014, we still not implemented. That's the challenge. So unless you have a collective conversation that can make the hard choice, and then we are able to implement quickly and timely and act as a system, we're aiming for the serious, serious challenge. For me, that is, I'm going to stop there, allow my colleagues to respond to other things that they've identified, and then whatever's missed, I'll come back and provide those answers to that. Max, you?
Thanks very much. So we obviously haven't been able to divide up the questions, and there's some which I'm not sure who's best placed to answer. So what I've asked is after I'll speak, and then Jeff will speak, and then I'd like another opportunity, because I'm going to leave a whole lot out. You may be better placed. So I'm going to try pick some quick, short answers to, because I think there were some specific things. The first I'll address was Ms. Kesson's question about static students and fees and inconsistency. So I think we all know that the static protocol requires that you don't charge static students more than South African students. There is, however, a small loophole in that, which is that where there are real costs, administrative costs, for accepting and processing international students, there can be an administrative fee. For example, you have to help students with study visas. You have to help them with health insurance issues, because they're not covered. You usually have to help with housing issues, which are treated differently. They don't have the same thing. There are a variety of things, checking their university, their school degrees. So there are real costs. And most of us have an office which deals with international students, and you can cost that office. What should happen is that there should be a flat rate administrative fee for all static students. We've recently done an assessment to look at what was happening, and I confirm what you're saying, which is that many universities charge a fee which is way higher than one could possibly justify as an administrative fee. And so the variability between universities, in my view, is inappropriate, and it should be, the department should investigate it and should say this is a reasonable administrative fee, no one can charge more than that, and all static students should be. Now, linked to that, I want to suggest that you may want to, or the DIRCA may want to reconsider the static protocol, because you heard how many of the international students are coming from static countries, and it's not clear why they should. We turned down many much better students from other countries because static students have preference in order to meet, say, the 5% target. And it also means that there's not very clear reason why a student from further north would be paying three or four times more than a student from static. But that's clearly an international relations issue. It does mean that the universities, to some extent, are trapped by that. And this leads me to the second point, which is that a question was asked, I think you asked, Ms. Killian, which are the countries that have 30%? I'll leave that for Mr. Mabela-Bela to respond to which countries. But for many of us, there is an important factor, which was in recruiting international students. It wasn't made as explicit. It is in the presentation, and that is profit. So we want international students for because they enrich the student life, they help us create global citizens, they enrich the future human resource of the country, because many of them will stay here and they will fill the need for those PhDs that we don't have. But profit is important. And for most countries, most other universities in other countries that have 30-40% international students, it's because their governments too have reduced the amount of funding that is going to locals to fund students and to fund research. And in almost all cases, other than in European countries where the system is slightly different, in almost all cases, the fees for international students are much higher, and the reason is to help the universities fund themselves. And certainly at UCT, and I'm sure at most other universities in South Africa, the non-SADC kind of students are cross-subsidizing the others and are helping to fill the hole in our funds. And one of the reasons that the numbers are going to go up is because the money from government subsidies is going down. And the question is, why shouldn't static students be contributing to that too? Most of the static students who come to us are not poor students. For better or worse, they're the children of parliamentarians, politicians, big business people, because when you come here, the fees may be reduced, but you've still got to pay accommodation and you're far away from home. You've got to pay transport, you've got to buy your own medical aid as a requirement, and I can tell you that the non-fee costs of being here are much higher than the fee costs. And so the fact that they have tells us that they're middle class or upper class students and they could actually pay anything. We should rather have a financial means tested system if we're concerned about equity that applies to all students across the board. Second issue, moving on from students, is refugees. Refugees are treated, as far as I know, by all universities, but I certainly can say by the University of Cape Town, as South Africans. We, and I understood this was a rule, are not allowed to charge higher fees for refugees than we do for others. And in fact, we don't even charge that administrative fee that I mentioned. What is a problem for them, though, is that they're not eligible for NISTA funding. And in most cases, not eligible for other financial aid funding that is raised, mostly from donors, because donors like to give for South African students to be educated. Third point, home affairs. Home affairs is the bane of our life. This ought to be low-hanging fruit because it shouldn't cost us anything. Almost all the other proposals we've been talking about, all the other needs, are things that require money. Home affairs should not be something that needs money to solve. But it is a huge problem, and we end up spending a lot of our own money supporting or both our staff and students to work through home affairs because they can't do it. So we employ a couple of people whose job is 100% to deal with home affairs and try to get the study. But we've got 4,000 international students. Each of them, every year when they come back, needs a renewal of a student visa. We've got about 200 international staff, or many of them are permanent residents, so they're sorted finally. But if one of them recently, the government withdrew, was it Directive 38 or something, and now we've got a whole lot of staff and students stuck overseas, can't get back after the holidays, because the government wouldn't renew their visas in time, and the Home Affairs didn't renew their visas in time, and they can't get back in. So it's also the case that in today's world, many academics are two-career families, and we can get a work permit for the academic, because if we can argue that it's a scarce skill, but then we can't get a work permit for the staff. Mm-hmm. And in today's world, that family will not move to Thailand. And we're competing in a global market. We're competing against salaries that are much higher than our salaries, work environments and research infrastructure that is much better developed. If we start putting other kinds of obstacles in front of these top academics globally, they don't come. And so we try very hard, and I suspect in many places you find that there are sort of loopholes are looked for, you know, to create jobs for other people and to create jobs which appear to be unique and unfillable by anyone except the person's wife or husband in order to get them. But we shouldn't have to fight that, and there should be a recognition about that. The fourth point is about funding options for postgraduates. So here I think this is a much longer discussion, and really also has a lot to do with NISFAS, but as I think everyone knows, NISFAS only funds the first degree. It doesn't fund the BTEC, doesn't fund honours, doesn't fund masters, doesn't fund doctorate. In 2 years ago, doctorates were funded out of the blue because there was a whole pot of CETA money left over that had been accumulated. We all got very excited because we thought this was going to be a recurrent expenditure. And we took on a whole lot of PhD students, and I think you'll see that part of that growth in those graphs of South African students is the result of CETA money which came through via NISFAS to fund PhDs. It's terminated as of next year, as of 2015, and we're going to be seeing a drop, I think, of PhD students as a result. Now, you asked, or someone asked about gradations within these, BCom honours, other honours. And I think that the reason why that may appear to be the case is that there are quite a lot of research grants include funding for postgraduate students. For example, the NRF grants and the research chairs that the NRF fund include money for PhD students and for master's students, but only if the master's is a thesis master's. As far as I know, there is no funding for honours and others of any sort, unless the university itself makes that money available. And I can't speak in this regard, I don't know what other universities do, but at the University of Cape Town, and I suspect some others do this, we recognize that honors is the bottleneck to postgraduate study because everyone has to do an honors before they can go on to master's and doctorate. And so while you can get some research funds for the master's and the doctorates, you can get NISFAS for the undergraduates, you've got no money for the honors students. And so we allocate out of our core budget are the block grants that should be going to paying the salaries or to be paying part of the research that Mr. Mabizela was referring to. We put that into virtues for honours students because that's the way. But indeed, one of the key bottlenecks, I think, of course, most honours students just fund themselves, but that's why it's such a barrier to poorer students and to black students. But then I wanted to pick up what I think will be the much more controversial issue, which Professor Habib started on, about differentiation, agreement or disagreement within the sector, and what we mean. And I want to pick up on Mr. Bata's comment about, are we going to fund the additional 12 universities, and how do we raise them? And that's where I think the rubber hits the road with respect to the debate on differentiation. So I want to take it out of our own environment and ask you to take a systemic view using the analogy of the U.S. In the United States, there are approximately 4,000 post-secondary school institutions. So this would, many of those would be the so-called community colleges or the college systems where you can get associate degrees and four-year degrees. There would also be vocational training institutions. Only 220 out of those 4,000, so that's 5%, are allowed to issue PhDs. The others don't even have the permission to issue PhDs. In our country, every university is allowed to issue PhDs, and there seems to be a drive that they should issue more and more. The argument that there should be more than 36% of academics with PhDs is premised on the view that all universities should be offering PhDs. Now, that's where there's a debate, and probably there isn't agreement even across the institution. I think none of us think that amongst the 23, 25 universities now, that there should be a prohibition on giving PhDs. I think we should develop islands of research excellence at every university. I think there needs to be some postgraduate studies, but it shouldn't be an aspiration that everyone should have, what Vitz has, probably 60, 70% of staff with PhDs. And it shouldn't be an aspiration that the number of PhDs given out of the total number should exceed more than about 5% of students in most of those universities. Because we need universities that produce tens of thousands of very well qualified accountants and lawyers and doctors. And those institutions are actually, the differentiation means that they should be funded properly and fully to do that. They won't get less money than the other universities, but it will be a different approach in the funding formula. So I think we must be much more careful when we just do a sort of shotgun approach to increasing all PhDs and our staff, funding PhDs everywhere, and increasing research funding everywhere. That's a big and much longer issue. I don't want to take more time now on that. Then the next question that I'm going to address is, amongst the PhDs, why is there only a 46% success rate, and why is the success rate amongst Africans lower than amongst others? I think that one should have a perspective, and unfortunately I can't offer you that perspective because I don't have the international figures here, but I would be very surprised if it was even as high as 46% in other countries. PhDs, par excellence, of all the degree programs, is a program where people start thinking this is what they want to do, or thinking they might like to get a PhD. Then discover that A is not something you can do part-time. Many people start PhDs part-time, thinking that because you don't have to go to class, because you don't have to be in lectures, that it's something you can do on the weekends or in the evening. They don't realize that it is a completely full-time activity for at least 4 years, 3 to 4 years. And so most of the dropout, I would suggest, is because people have underestimated the commitment that's required. And many of them do not have funding. I've already gone on at length about how the fact that there is no funding for PhD students. So they are at work, or they're holding down part-time jobs, and they have to choose, can they continue? If we want the PhD rate to improve, the success rate, first thing we're going to have to do is to fund PhDs fully so they can live without working. And then we also have to persuade them that they're willing to go to the age of 30 or so while earning $250,000 a year or so, whatever is a stipend for a PhD student, $180,000, which most 30-year-olds think is too little to earn, especially when they're graduates, they've got master's degrees, and they could be earning three or four times that in the marketplace. So the new program, we've had the Department of Higher Education has presented us with a proposal for a PhD Next Generation Academic Support Program. It's looking very good. And just to give you what in one sentence it is that instead of making people do their PhDs and then giving them a job, it offers them a job first and funds the PhD while they're doing this and gives them 4 years to get their PhD before they actually have to start working. So it has the advantage of paying a proper salary right from the start. It has the advantage of guaranteeing them a job, assuming that they pass their PhD, and it has the advantage of giving them 4 years to focus on the PhD rather than being lecturers as well as PhD students. So I think that's the why is Africa? No, probably it's an extension of the same reason, I think, but it's also has to be said that the feeders into we take in a lot of students both from other countries and from our own who we discover are not good enough to do a PhD. So the quality of undergraduate degrees is not the same everywhere, and the quality of masters is not the same. And sometimes you can't judge when someone is coming in whether they're going to make it. So I think that may also be a factor. Mr. Kakana made a very valid point that if the research is relevant in addressing our problems, there will probably be money for it. And I'd like to suggest that we schedule another session with you to talk about research, because I think there's a real risk, a real misperception, and it's an indictment of the universities that we can't communicate this, that we don't communicate this better. But there's a misperception that somehow our research is irrelevant, or that most of it is not addressing the local problems. I've looked at this again in our own university context, and I would say that if there's 10% of work that is what you might call fundamental, basic research, which has no almost immediate relevance to the problems that South Africa and the region faces, it would be a lot. I think the vast majority of this, so we do a lot of work on solar energy. We've just, some of you may have met the minister, the Danish minister, who's listening. Denmark is funding collaborative to work on wind farms and wind atlases, as I've heard, projects just been completed. Fantastic stuff. Oceanography, fisheries, mineral resources, legal issues and constitutionalism, in the humanities, anthropology, religious studies, sociology, politics, there's almost nothing that isn't relevant and related to what we do, but we haven't been communicating that well. There's a sense, even something like the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array, which is research about the origin, whether there's life out there, and you may say, what's the relevance of that for South Africa when we can't provide sanitation to our chaplain? But it would be wonderful to have an opportunity to explain what the spin-off benefits are of the astronomy research in creating engineers that will populate the industries of the country, in creating fiber optic networks that will ensure that every town and village is communicated, is connected, etc. So the point is taken, and we have to address it. This is not so much, my next point is not so much an answer to a question, but it comes out of many questions, which is there something, how are we managing, and is there a crisis, particularly around the fee, around the budget and the declining budget? Now, you haven't asked the question, but you might have asked us, is how come we're doing so well? How come some universities in particular are doing so well, given the trend of declining money for research and declining money for students? And the answer is that we've increased the fees, and you see it in that graph on the table. Fees have gone up in general by twice the rate of inflation, sometimes by more than that. And that's the only way we've been able to survive. And I want to make this point because there's no doubt in my mind that in the 4 or 5 years that this committee is going to sit, someone is going to say, the minister or students, someone's going to say, put a cap on fees. Tell the universities what they should charge, don't allow them to charge their own fees. And I want to say that if there had ever been a cap on fees, we would have been, the system would have collapsed. It's only survived because fees have gone up at a high rate. What the Treasury needs to do is to ensure that students can pay those fees, poor students can pay those fees, and NSFAS obviously is a vehicle, and I think it's that the initiatives around NSFAS are generally very positive. So it's a sort of an alert about whenever the suggestion of capping fees or capping increases comes up to call the universities and have a discussion with us about what the consequences would be. Okay, my last comment that I will suggest so that I give others a chance relates to, I think it was Honourable Bazzotti's question about EST, DHS, should these be combined? Is there a problem? I think it would be important for both this committee and the Parliamentary Committee on Science and Technology to have an overview, to have the big picture. But I have to say that one of the ways this differentiation has occurred, and the reason it has occurred, is because of the separate streams of funding, and it would be dangerous, therefore, if they were somehow merged or combined. So DHET comes with an approach that is primarily funding teaching. And teaching needs to be funded equally everywhere. The differentiation we're talking about is not about some universities being better teaching universities than other universities. And the funding formula generally does that. And you heard from Mr. Magazella that it's only 14% of money that basically goes on research. It's a tiny amount of the budget. And of that, 40% goes to the stronger research universities, 60% is going to others. So even then, that research is not, that funding is not achieving any differentiation to speak of. The differentiation is happening largely through the DST funding. And until very recently, most DST funding is driven by merit, outputs, quality of research grants, quality of researchers, and so it goes disproportionately, we must acknowledge that, it goes disproportionately to those six research universities in the country. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That's why the system is performing as well as it is, and it should be encouraged. There is also an equity and redress component there. One needs to, and DST takes account of that too. There are redress components, as you heard, in the development, research development grant within DHET. But I think that it's actually serving the country quite well that you have these two channels and that they are independent and that they're driven by independent goals. DST's goal is to make this country the best science, the delivery of science and innovation that it can be, and not to compromise on that. And I think that's what it needs to do. In terms of research infrastructure, Madam Chair, you asked, and most of that, there's a little bit that comes, $74 million or so, comes from the infrastructure grant from DHET, and that's a three-year grant, isn't it? So, I mean, $20 million a year, let me tell you, is the cost of one expensive microscope. And that's for the country. An expensive scanning electron microscope costs in the region of $50 million today. So $74 million for 3 years for the country's infrastructure is sorry? For 1 year, okay. There'll be a few microscopes in the country each year. So the most of the research infrastructure money comes from DST and from NRF. So there's the research equipment grant, and that's where we apply. But in fact, most of it comes from overseas. And that brings me to the question of the third stream income, which someone asked. That research third stream income is not endowment income. UCT probably has an average size endowment for the historically white universities. Our endowment is about 400 to 500 million rand, which means that we generate about 20 million a year that we can use, because we can't touch the capital. We're not allowed to, so we can only touch the interest. So we generate about 20 million, which feeds into our research, feeds into funding, bursaries, research, all sorts of things. But 20 million is tiny. We generate over a billion rand a year in research money. And that's the third stream income. The endowment contributes almost nothing. It helps us do some nice stuff at the moment. I mean, it should grow in one would like. It's not to say it's not important in the long run. So I can't say nationally what the total makeup of third stream income is, but I suspect that in most cases it's external research grants and contracts.
Very good, Chair. Thank you very much. I will answer two questions. Thank you very much. I'll answer two questions that were posed. Countries with a higher proportion of international students, the UK is one example, Australia is another, and the US. And as you know, there's a huge East Asian market that these countries are taking from, China, Korea, and other related countries. So they've put their numbers quite significantly in the last few years. Well, I would also like to respond very briefly to the question that Honorable Buzoli also raised. Is it a toothless? Are we being listened to? Well, I think in the last few years, we have been having very constructive discussions with the department. I mean, the very proposal that Mr. Malizela touched on, staffing of our universities, was essentially a product of the work that HISA has done on developing a proposal for the building of the next generation of academics, which was then discussed in government. I must indicate that that proposal has now seen its way into the National Development Plan. And the National Development Plan does say that proposal must be implemented with immediate effect. So we've been having conversations with the department, and that those conversations have now led to the development of the proposal that the department has now come up with. And we will be jointly implementing it. Secondly, on the issue of reporting regulations, you know that in the last few years, there was some form of an outcry from the university sector with regard to the new reporting regulations that were published for implementation. We have engaged the department. Those regulations have now been revised quite fundamentally, and they are now going to be implemented in the first year, month of 2015. We are engaging the department now on next person related matters. We just had a colloquium recently where both the Treasury, HISA, the department, the presidency, SAOS, and others were called upon into one room, and we had engagements about NISFAS related challenges, and there seems to be some form of a way forward that has emerged out of that. And I can go on and on about other initiatives that we have taken, we've been in discussions with the government on. And for me, it seems like in instances where, for instance, we raise issues with evidence on the table, there is normally a positive response from the department. Secondly, also, you wanted to know whether the higher education income source that we reflect here includes NRF. It does. Because the data was sourced from the DHET, it was also sourced from financial statements in annual reports submitted by universities. So one would assume that the bulk of NRF funding would then be catered for. But this funding, remember, is up to 2010. 2011, 12, and 13, I think, would then come into play.
So, two quick things I want to end off with, because my colleagues have answered quite a few of the questions. One is that there was a question around why is it that, how do we create black, and in particular African South African professors? And this is a challenge, as you well know. But we've got to understand this as a comprehensive process. The first is we need pipeline. You can't have African professors if you don't have African senior lecturers and lecturers. And you don't get African senior lecturers and lecturers if you don't have the master's students and the PhD students. So it's a pipeline question, and that's the first thing that we've got to understand. If you're blocking any one of these pipelines, you're in trouble. The second part of this thing is whether we like it or not. It's a 20-year process. For you to get a PhD in this country starting from undergraduate, it's probably a 10, 12-year process. After that, you need at least, and a very good academic would need at least another 10 years of experience. And so you're looking at a 20-year process. And so we've got to think through. Now, there are individuals, as you've often made the case, that can circumvent that process because they're brilliant young. But that's not the norm. Under the norm, and this is not South Africa, it's any country in the world. It's a 20, 25-year process, and we've got to think that through. And then the third, which has Max said, is the issue of creating an enabling environment. Part of it's money. But part of it is, you know, when you were a lecturer 30, 40 years ago, you didn't have the administrative burdens you do now. So actually, you say, that's something that you can do if we actually want to create this is something that we need to be concerned about. So I think those are challenges we've got to confront. I want to end off by two things. The first is, and you know, even though Max makes the point that there is a differentiating happening between the differential funding programs, my worry is it's happening by default. It's not a thought-through process collectively by us. And it's not a thought-through process because we can't make hard decisions on issues. Let's put the big elephant in the room. The research-intensive universities
there is not anything like universities. That's the point. It's the question of race. Then, and how we address that has become an issue now. Let's tackle that question. Let's have the courage to say, how do we create an issue and how do we address that question? And for me, as long as we duck that question, this is why I carry on saying, we need to sit around the table and say, what do we want as a system to achieve what thing? And what are the choices that we are making in that system? Even in those research-intensive six universities, by the way, they are different mandates. So the University of Pretoria has a very different mandate from the University of Bratislava. It's in its mandate. It says it doesn't want to be a research-intensive university. And so it wants to achieve a much greater complexity than a simple narrative. Now, we need a debate. We need a coherent debate. And it's not going to be simple teaching, simple research. There's a whole series of complexities that are going to be required in between. How do we achieve those kinds of things in this historical moment? That's the kind of thing. And then finally, an alumna. Sorry, on Sunday. There is three sets of institutions on endowments. There's some that don't have any endowments. Absolutely not. We're running from hand to mouth, and frankly, they're running at a deficit every year, which means that the deficit's increasing. And what happens is, after 10 years, the department is forced to intervene, as has happened two or three occasions. That's the one scenario. The second is a group of institutions that max, this is about 400, 500 million. We're about probably, which is about exactly the same place, which then generates a 5% return, something anything between 20 and 25 million. You don't want to do it any more than a 5% return because then you start risking your endowment and your capital. And that's something that you need to be careful. And then there's a third group of institutions that do have a significant amount of cash. So there are institutions with 6 billion in reserves and 8 billion in reserves. Now that's a whole historical reason. Now this is the real issue. It's not simply the amount of cash you have. It's also where your cash is invested. So you come to a place like that, actually, and I'll use this as an example because I know it well. We have a number of assets. We have Frankenwald, we have Donald Gordon, this thing. But those are not assets that are equity in the market where you can earn a 600 or 800, 300 million in return. What those are is assets that are meant to advance the academic enterprise. In the case of Donald Gordon, it would be an enterprise that about producing subspecies. We've got a good health consortium. It runs a turnover of R1 billion a year. But our return on that is R2 million. Now you might say, on R1 billion you get a R2 million turnover, that's horrendous. Well, the problem is, it's not meant to make large amounts of income. One of its purposes is to be a research broker to manage the big research contracts that come into the system. So in an institution that has R6 billion in the markets is a very different institution that may have a similar amount in actual infrastructure and assets. The returns will be different, and so the income. So we've got a very complex system, ironically. And part of our system has some of the best benchmarks around the world around institutional autonomy. They be able to make choices, and it's precisely those institutional autonomy and the flexibility we have in that has allowed us to compensate for the challenges in the system. But we need to stop thinking of the system as a whole, because the undercurrent in the system has been we're looking at the system through the lens of the apartheid era. And unless we change that, we're never going to be thinking coherently of the system. Finally, there was a question about, and I do want to clarify, about the numbers of students that are unemployed, graduates. Now, there's two sets of research that are worth knowing. Firstly, from the graduates from universities have a lower unemployment rate than any other category. It doesn't mean they don't have an unemployment rate. They do. But their unemployment rate is lower than any other category in the system. So it pays you to actually get a first degree because your chances go up in the system on getting a job. Second, on the research stuff, there is research that shows 87% of research in the South African system is applied of some kind or the other. It's very, very directed towards applied. there is what is called blue sky research, a small proportion. But remember this, the blue sky research of today becomes the applied research of tomorrow. You might think, why are we looking at people doing high-level mathematics in South Africa? Because high-level mathematics speak to algorithms that define the electronic banking system in this country. If you didn't do the one, you wouldn't be able to do the other. And that's the thing. Don't assume. And then the third thing I think that is important, even with the graduates that come out of the system, the university can only do so much. If the economy is not expanding to employ, however much we produce, that's not there. It's a two-way process. It's getting the economy and the university and other sectors of the society talking to each other. Because if we don't do that, we are in serious conversation. You know, Max will tell you, we produce 1,200 doctors in this country. If you ask Karen Mosaledi, he'll tell you we need 5,000.
Hey, Anna.
Bad. We're producing 1,200, we should be having between 4,000 and 5,000. If we don't stop thinking as a system and figuring out a plan, we're going to have a serious crisis in our system. That's why I come back to the thing. We actually need a collective conversation beyond the departments, beyond the portfolio committees, and beyond the sector. And I would love to see a conversation, if you're going to follow up, Chair, as a portfolio committee where you bring DOET, DST, Mini Health, and Treasury. And I will try and bring all of our vice chancellors to have a very, from the officials, to have a very frank conversation. And then let's not duck the question. Let's not take the big question, the hidden question that are, and tackle that. Because if we don't do that, we might be in trouble.
Done. Thank you very much for all the responses from where I am sitting. You have given us adequate responses to the questions that have been raised, but that does not stop me from finding out from my members if they've got follow-up questions. But the follow-up questions should be driven as follow-up, short and to the point. So it must not have a preface. Just go straight to the question. I'm looking at the time. Remember, we've got a city also, so if we can fast track. Alright, how many have got follow-up questions? Are you on your way? Thank you, Jay. Thank you so much for your contribution. Thanks for having. Really appreciate your contribution. Alright, how many? Alright, there's one. I will remember the chair. I actually had to give you a chance to ask all the questions. So I'll ask. I also have got questions that have not been asked. But can be allowed that. And then you close this meeting. Thank you very much. Over to you, Mr. Katim.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just have, I think, only about two follow-up questions. So I'm going to try and be very briefly, and it's directed particularly at Dr. Price, some of the answers that you have given me, and thank you for that. Firstly, around the implementation of the SADC protocol and the administration fees, and I was aware of the administration fees as far as the questions. I know that there are those that are financed. I wanted to just know from your staff or from your colleagues, can you give me examples of any institutions that can be found to be charging in excess of those, what would be deemed reasonable for these students? Because it has become a problem in some instances. But I just wanted to know from Nisa how far on top of is Nisa on this issue, and are we aware of any, even if it's one example of institutions, and the extent of that problem that you guys have now picked up in that regard. And then in terms of the there not being funding for honours course of masters, for PhD students as well, there was an example that was given of an upcoming project with the department for, I think, PhD students in particular, gaining employment, etc. I don't know if it would be yourself or the department or both to really give some more clarity, because I think that's very exciting. To get a better understanding of that project, and to what extent would it assist students currently? So how many students are really, where is the need? Has that been determined? And in terms of the project, when will that really come into place? And what is the extent of the amount of needy students or candidates that will be assisted in that instance? Thank you.
All right, my question is, do you want to respond or?
No, ma'am, I just wanted to get the question clearly. I missed the part of the project.
Okay.
Which project?
The career development.
Next generation. All right, can I then ask my question? Thank you very much. Prof, I would like to know if you have a plan, as Lisa, a plan to include Tibet colleges in your structure as they are now falling under Department of Higher Education and Training, but also in your own thinking, how much do you think is needed from the GDP in percentage terms in order to address the challenges that our higher education is confronted with? The next question is, I just want to find out from you if, alright, let me give you this scenario. In one of the reports of your Council on Higher Education, it's actually an executive summary of the audit report of the University of Venda, where they are touching on xenophobic tensions between local and foreign personnel emanating from differentials in the employment benefits, but also perception of preeminence given to foreign academics in high-level appointments. How prevalent is or are these tensions? Should universities have quotas for employment of foreign nationals? Does HISA keep data of South African students in overseas universities? If yes, could we share that information? Again, in terms of the research chair, there's a skewed distribution where previously advantaged universities have more chairs than historically disadvantaged. This talks to transformation. So what are the causes and how can this be corrected to ensure equitable distribution to build research capacity in the higher education institutions? And then the last one, I think here would be, do you as HISA promote collaboration in research between universities, especially those that have research chairs and those that do not have? We are on a transformation journey. Everybody, this is now a buzzword. But what we'd like to find out from you is whether you have a transformation plan for the university or for the higher education institution. Because I think you can also have authority and influence over these matters.
Yeah.
What I can say to you only, Mr. Kassim, is that I think that an administrative fee in the region of about 3,000 to 5,000 rand is reasonable. Cost based on actual costing in one situation, but I can't see why it would be very different anywhere else. And I would say that it's for the department. HISA doesn't keep this sort of information or doesn't solicit it from the universities, but I think it would be an easy matter. Much of this would be on the websites of universities to go and look at them and see whether there are much above, and then to ask them to say how is it justified, and they may have good reasons why it's different. This next so let me pause there. I think if Mr. Mavazel is going to take the next generation project, then he can, otherwise I can say something about that.
What do you say?
Thank you very much, ma'am. Can I just touch on that one of SADC students? We did a survey. I think we then got the report in 2011. So the numbers I'm going to be talking about
from 2011. The what the survey showed was that the institutions range from not charging any levy, zero levy, to a maximum of 3,000 rand. Those that are charging a levy, a maximum of 3,000. That was then, but maybe now it may have grown. Now, one thing also that was said by Dr. Price earlier on, the residence fees are not subsidized by the department. So there could be fluctuations there, and of course also the residences at the different institutions. There are those that are low cost residences, those that are high cost residences. So even there at the institutions, the amounts vary in terms of the residences. But also then in terms of the outside of the levy now, the fees that the students would be paying at the residences would then have that variation also in terms of the foreign students, so that one depends on the institutions. But in terms of the levy, that was the range that we got. And I think the suggestion about capping that one, I think it's a good suggestion. Apparently, it was there since the Minister Kada Asmal's time, but there has been reluctance in enforcing it. And when there's reluctance, there are reasons why you don't want to force something. But maybe we can target there for now. Then on the PhD project, the idea is to inject 400 academics per annum for the next 3 years, starting from the 2015-16 financial year. That is the idea. And so if it's 3 years, then you end up with 1,200 in the system during that period. And then also then supported by the department for that period firstly, and then the next level would be the next 3 years again of continuing to support those students. So those academics. So you stop the intake and then continue to support those for the next 3 years again. And there would be different categories. You've got academics in terms of the support now. You've got the academics who are there already in the system. Then you've got the new academics that you would be recruiting into the system. We've got, there is some money, and that part of that money is the money that we are using now in the research development, because it's already doing that. Research development and teaching development. Yeah, there's another component, it's just that we've been focusing on research today. But in the teaching, there's also the teaching as in the output that we are having, output in terms of the students that you graduate undergrad. But also there's teaching development grant, which is even higher than the research development. I said research development is 187 million of the budget. But the teaching development is in the range of about 500 million rand. So it's to take that money, pull it together, part of it, not all of it, part of it, then introduce this project. The success of it, I guess, will be in the implementation of it. You know, you'll see whether you are able to get the 400 students that you want, the 400 academics that you want, and whether we have enough money anyway to do that. The ambition is to have 400 per annum for the next year, but then the reality is something different, and the reality is that 2 years money, do we have money, and also do we have the people, you know, the academics or students that graduate who want to be academics to attract them. And I can assure you this is going to be quite a doing. To attract them, you know, we may have money, but to just get them, it's going to be quite a challenge, I guess.
Mr. Mabizela, yes. If you can round up.
Oh, yes.
Time constraints.
Yes. I think those were the two questions, ma'am. I don't want to get into the other ones about research, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Let me quickly say that in addition to that, by the way, I think all of the
universities
have also their own career development, staff development programs. So the idea is not simply the department, but the department and the universities. And I know of at least 5 to 10 universities that are running similar programs around this. I just wanted to quickly answer some of your questions on where we go. GDP, you suggested what should be the funding. The Department of Higher Education and Training, under the auspices of the Deputy President before he became Deputy President, did a study on the funding formula. And that study suggested that South Africa's subsidy to its universities is about $22 billion. And that if you did it on the global average, not the OECD average, but the global average, it should really be at $37 billion. So if you're looking at that and if you were to extrapolate a kind of percentage proportional increase in relation from 22 to 30, this is on percentage of GDP, I would think you would be looking at shifting it from about 0.7 to about 1.2%, which is where Australia is at this point. And that's what you're really looking at to address this. On the xenophobic tensions, by the way, I was the chair of the task team on the University of India audit. And one of the things that was quite striking is there were these tensions. But you're in a real tricky situation. It's like doctors. We lose a lot of our doctors to overseas markets. Then we recruit from the rest of the continent into our district. And the same thing happens with PhD students. I mean, with professorial. A large number of people come in, but they want to break in. They break in. They sometimes don't break into the universities in urban areas. They break into the universities in rural areas. Then they leave, and then a new ground of systems come in. And that's become the kind of pattern. And that's what we were seeing at the University of India. It's people who come there, they'll spend 3 or 4 years there, establish their reputation, and jump to one of the bigger urban universities. And to prevent them to recruit, it was then trying to recruit people out of the system. And it was, they were finding it particularly difficult to get senior professorial staff going into this. I'm having a conversation, by the way, with Peter Ibaki. About precisely how this can provide assistance in this regard around teaching and such. And I know that there's similar conversations with Limpopo. I know other institutions like UCT, Stellenbosch, etc., having similar partnerships. But there is a struggle to get appropriately qualified staff in all of the rural campuses, and therefore that's the thing. And then finally you asked on the research capacity. Let me just say,
Should universities have quotas for employment of foreign nationals, maybe to manage the
tension? Yeah, I accept that what you led up to, this is why I'd like a much more collective conversation. Okay. If you establish a quota system, you might limit the university's ability to cross-subsidize existing local students by recruiting. So you want to play that, and it's very different when you're looking at PhD students or when you're looking at undergraduate students. So you really need to understand it. So I would much rather have this collective conversation of trying to understand the system. How do we want to act as a system? What needs do we need to do? And which institutions are meant to achieve which complexity of need? And then finally on research chairs that you raise. Look, it's true. If you look at the nature of the way research chairs are deployed, because the research chairs are largely meant to drive research in particular, it's been skewed largely in the direction of what we've seen in the research-intensive universities, I think, and that's something there. The department has been mindful of it. But, you see, sometimes you can create perverse consequences. So let me give you, in a number of cases, it's allocated research chairs in other institutions. And in some cases, it worked, like Rose has a number of research chairs. But in one or two, and Limpopo has one or two very good research chairs. But in one or two other cases where we allocated researchers, we can't find anybody to go there. And so you end up remaining at research chair being unfilled for 3 years. And now what the NRF is doing is taking back the research chair to try and reallocate it. But in the process, we must do everything. Now, I don't think the answer is no. But again, I think the answer shouldn't be, let's have a formula that applies to everybody. I think we should start by saying, what is the mandate of each institution to achieve our needs? How does this plan fit into that agenda? And then how do we allocate? So I do think we need that conversation. So if I'm ending, Chair, my urge will be we desperately as a system need a cross-portfolio conversation, perhaps with the ministers in the room, between Treasury, Higher Education, DST and Health, for a collective conversation around the real issues that confront us. If we let this happen by default, we're in trouble. Thank you.
On the plan to include TVET colleges in the infrastructure?
Yeah. Well, they do have their own structure.
They are not, we only represent public universities, so there are no plans to incorporate them. They do have the structure for support that plays the same role that it plays for universities.
Remember, we are all expected to move over time. So I would appeal to you to look at it, because they had that structure before the new development. But with the latest developments, I'm sure you will look at how do you align.
It might be useful to actually say that what we should be doing is having a conversation with them on a regular basis.
Mm.
So, you know, perhaps one of the things we are, and we are talking about that, is we do need to involve them. So they've got a structure, we've got a structure. We probably need a greater level of conversation that says we should be regularly consulting each other, we should be having understandings of creating some levels of mobility within the system. These structures are not going to work. These institutions are not going to work without some significant support from the university system for the training, for the training.
Exactly.
The training.
Yeah, sure.
So we do need a conversation, and that's something that we probably do need to.
Yeah, and also a collaboration strategy. Because if the emphasis on TVET is on skills development, the universities must also design and show a curriculum to assist the training of the teachers who will be teaching at the TVET, I mean, colleges. I'm just thinking aloud. You know your sector better. But I'm thinking the university must start to think about, you know, those curriculums that will assist in ensuring that we have qualified teachers to teach, or lecturers to teach at the TVET colleges. Okay. No, it's true that I've triggered some thinking on this matter. Baba, do you want, is there anything?
Just a quick addition. Just an addition to that. Yes, we do have a project that is working on the development of lecturers at the TVET colleges. But also, just to add, there is a project or program that helps FISA on HIV and AIDS, but it's spread beyond that, and the board of that, but you know, HISA uses language of strategy group, but basically the board of that HIS program is incorporating the management from the TVET sector, and it's a true collaboration between the universities and the TVET sector and the government and the department. That process. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Indeed, we've had a vigorous engagement, and I'm sure you all are sharing the same sentiments that it was a fruitful engagement. I then would want to quickly request the researcher or the content advisor just to give us that high level summary of things that we have to take forward. Quickly, we're running out of time.
Thank you, sir. I'll try to use my valley voice.
Please.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can come closer then.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let me.
As long as you don't forget that you're not an honorable member. No, I'm just saying.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Just to summarize what has been sort of the point here in this meeting. Firstly,
anything that is going to take forward.
Yes.
Mm.
First one is, in the system has inadequate funding. Therefore, the government needs to have efforts to fund the system in terms of subsidies, infrastructure, and such grants. That's the first one. Second one is, the system is not producing sufficient number of postgraduates, the master's and the doctoral graduates in the country. Also, apparently, the honors
because it is one of the sort of bottlenecks because of the funding system that we have in here. Thirdly, we need to have the presentation as it was said here. The C-class is driven, it should be C-class driven, and such institutions are seen as such institutions. However, the presentation is required to produce the necessary skills that are needed in the country. In SA, every country is offering, in every is offering changes, and apparently there should be sort of a change in that moving forward. Maybe seeing which one should do that and others. Like people said, like in USA, some of them, they don't offer at all PhD, they just offer teaching degrees only. There's been a talk for the last, I think, 6 or so years about National Digital Library, which has not been sort of implemented up to yet, and Professor was saying that we need to act urgently and implement things sort of in a quick manner. But there are two options that were put forward by Abizela. One option was to take current funding and pay in bulk in terms of their licenses, or secondly, take money from the system. Apparently, this thing is really not really, you don't take off, it's very unlikely to use the fiscal, the second option. Another problem that we have in apparently is the student immigration rules that we have. The Home Affairs, apparently, like you see, about 4,000 million students that they have a year, and the staff that they're using to assist them in their visas annually, which is taking a lot of money from that, maybe we need to relax some of those sort of regulations for those students from affected in other countries across the world. Production of new generation thematic academics. There is a proposal by CISA we need to produce new academics, and then the government is having this project that was by now by Mr. Mabizela, who said that apparently they're going to have 400 students or academics per year over a 3-year period, put money there, assist them moving forward, and therefore see how many of them will progress to be professors in the near future. We need to have engagement apparently with the National Treasurer, the Presidency, and the NEPA, the DFAT, and everybody else together to sit around the table to talk about issues that we really need to, in terms of us moving forward in our engagement as the department, because apparently the funding issue cannot really be talked about if there's no treasurer in the room. Therefore, we need to put them together and talk. And also, Professor is going to put all the VCs in this room also, that we're going to tackle the issues really which are critical to us moving forward. And also, HISA does regularly talk to the civil structures to support them in the future. And I know, and also, we've got this thing that we want the university to produce literals for TIVET. Therefore, that will sort of maybe we'll be able to come to a solution in terms of how to involve. That's the problem that we're having for now. We don't have literals that are qualified at TIVET College, but maybe from then we can have them moving forward. And maybe lastly, some institutions do have reserves. Some have them. Some don't have them. As proper saying, they work from hand to mouth as it is, and they will have every year a deficit. Some will have about 6 million. Some will have about 8 billion. But what it is where do you invest your money? Basically, what is important is what proper saying. I think that is more or less what we have here, my high-level issues that we have proposed.
Do you want to add a cover? I think the only one that I think was left out.
I want to add maybe one more. The PhDs that are coming to study from here, from the countries and from African countries, apparently they bring here. There have been a lot of things, but a lot of them have been profit, which then cross-subsidize with our students, which is a good point that was put forward, that we cross-subsidize our students in terms of their fees. Thank you.
There was a proposal by Professor Price that we need to have another meeting that will be focusing on research. Again, also there was a proposal to fast-track the development of the policy on internationalization. Any other addition? Mr. Kafin? I got you.
Yeah.
Well, not in addition, no, I just think that that idea of the joint meeting between the portfolio committees and the treasury is exactly what we need.
Yeah, so it has cover.
Maybe it's my own fault, Jack. I'm just not sure whether it was covered for the department to investigate into the possible variability of the admin fee for the SADC students, as well as I think I don't know if it was a major issue that was raised around BTEC students and those masters that are not thesis master students, that there is no source of funding for them, and it's a bottleneck for poor students, honest students as well. It's a bottleneck, and it is a barrier to access for poorer students, particularly black students, to access those postgraduate studies, masters, doctorates, PhDs, etc. Going forward.
Okay. As a committee, I hope I'm speaking correctly and representing the committee well. We feel strong that something has got to be done on NSFAS. Now, what has come up from the discussion is that there was a colloquium. We would like information sharing on the colloquium outcome, because that's it. The Department of Education was sitting in there, and the National Treasury was sitting in there. Then it's a something that we can use as a soft document to interrogate or ensure that some of the things that you agreed upon are planned. Even if it's not this year, in the outer years. All right. Okay, thank you very much. Indeed, we've had a very good meeting, which promises a very strong and a good working relationship as we move forward, and I'm sure you are happy. Let me allow you to make a closing statement, Prof.
Did I miss the one?
And then,
we just want to say thank you very much for giving us the opportunity. I do think this engagement between the Vice Chancellor and the Portfolio Committee and the Department can be very, very valuable, and we're happy to assist in whatever way we can do that.
Well, thank you so much for coming, and thank you for the invaluable contribution that you have made to this meeting. And I think this relationship will take us into the future. Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you so much. I know you've had tea. At least you want some more. There's tea served left. But the committee would like you. The committee members must remain so that you can adopt the minutes. Shall we reconvene as members of the committee? Well, thank you so much, members. I must be honest, I'm very happy with your state of preparedness for this meeting. Indeed, the engagement was a meaningful one, and I'm sure you are also proud of yourself. I mean, good that if you have people of this caliber, you know they find their match enough. And the more they gain respect for us, the more we will have influence on them, you know, where we need to, you know. I think it's very important. But thank you very much. And shall we then proceed here? Here we have minutes that were circulated to the members. It was the first set of the 20th of August, and then second set of the 27th of August. Let's look at the first set of the 20th of August. I think it was circulated, am I right?
Yes.
If it was circulated, we will then take it that members have had the opportunity to look at them, browse through the minutes. Page 1, I will then zoom straight on to the correctness of the minutes. Page 1, none. Page 2, Page 2. And please, where you think there has been an improvement from our admin staff, say so, so that they can keep on improving. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. Shall we then propose any proposal for adoption of the minutes as a true record of what transpired, reflection of what transpired in the previous meeting? Any proposal? Main Daddy Main? Any seconder? Mr. Mbat. Thank you very much. Now let's zoom on to the next set of minutes, 27th of August. Even on this one, we will take it that members have read the minutes. Shall we look at page 1? Look at the correctness of the minutes. Any correction? Page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Done. Any proposal for adoption of the minutes? Ms. Nkulu, Mr. Suela seconding. So the minutes have been adopted as a true reflection of what transpired in the previous meeting. Thank you very much. And then we have added an item on our agenda. It's an item on media statement. Yes. All right. I will then request the person who sponsored this item is Professor Pozzoli. I'll request Mr. Pozzoli to lead us in the discussion.
Thank you very much, Chair. You know, a couple of media statements have come out from this committee, but I understand, and I think it's good practice as well, for the committee to endorse media statements that come out of it. And for us to only issue statements if we have passed a resolution to do that.
Sorry. I'm supposed to concentrate. Okay. Talk after one.
Thanks.
Right?
Chair, I'm just making a very simple proposal that if we have things that we would like to bring to the attention of the media, which I think we should do, that we endorse them as a committee and that we perhaps have a resolution to that effect before our items are sent out to the media from the committee, formal items from the committee.
All right. There's a proposal on the table on how we deal with the media. The chairperson automatically becomes the spokesperson of the committee. Now, what has happened in the past, I have spoken on behalf of the committee, but in my media statement, I have taken the predominant views of the committee into consideration. Now, there's a proposal that all those views must be endorsed. I do want us to look at the practical way of dealing with this because, for instance, after a meeting like this one, I might meet a media person here, and I cannot act like a defeatist or somebody who's scared to do or to face the media and say, I'm sorry, I'm still going to ask Professor Pozzoli. I'm trying to look at the practical ways, but I'm officially the spokesperson of the committee. And all chairpersons do speak on behalf of the committee. But I think what we can say is that I must take the majority view because I can't take political party view. I must talk about the majority view of the meeting. So if you allow me, I think let's proceed in that manner. Yes.
Chair, I don't think anyone wants to make a defeatist, but it's just that I remember when we were in Pretoria, we had a similar discussion. And there was a resolution in that discussion was to say that at least let's circulate it, if there's a formal statement or a statement that is going out, at least let us circulate it to members so that members can have an input into that via email. But also, Chair, I don't think the Chair said anything wrong to this point. I think we endorsed that. But I just feel a little bit when I'm not sure when this has gone out. We've not even been informed, you know, that something has been said on behalf of the portfolio committee. So if someone had to ask me something, I wouldn't know that at that point. So I feel a little bit taken aback in that instance. So not to take away from the practicality of your role as spokesperson, Chair, I just feel that, you know, if there's something formal that's been put out to the media or that's been spoken on behalf of the members of the portfolio committee, if we can just have it circulated, even if we don't have time to have an input in the desired time that the Chair needs it, but at least we'll be informed, you know, that there is something that has been said on this matter on behalf of the portfolio committee from yourself.
Okay, there's a proposal on the table. I think it's progressive, but I would like members to express themselves. Mr. Sirela and then Mr. Mbata, and then help us to close the discussion as well as we can quickly go and prepare for the next sitting. Okay.
Oh, okay, thank you, Chairperson. I think we do understand that the Chair is the spokesperson of the committee. And I would really suggest that where possible, we can consider informing the members where practically possible, because at times it's urgent. But then in that case, maybe we should follow the lead of the secretary to say, after having issued a statement, then you can notify us that there was this and this is what it is.
Thank you very much. I so wish our communications person was here, because also this work is done by the communications person. I don't invite, you know, the other time, you remember in our meeting, then I heard there was a Sunday camp session. Oh, okay. Taken by surprise, but it's okay. We just need to know how to manage, you know. All right, Mr. Mata?
I just want you to get guidance, Chair, as to what is the established tradition or the best practice that Parliament has been following. One, two, I wouldn't like to have a chair that is not spontaneous on issues, because higher education is very spontaneous. So I would request that we do give you freedom to rein on issues, because we might face a silence that is defeating to the committee. It doesn't mean we are speaking on behalf of the committee. You are speaking as a person who is a member of a party and which happens to have a chairperson role in the committee. But I do not want us to have an arrested situation where even myself, I'm not asked. I'm going to have views where people just ask me as DSS, and I will blow up and say whatever that is in our record has been agreed. And I'm not expecting people here to come and hold me on stage on those views. The thing is, let's find the best way amicable, but it mustn't be to regulate you.
Okay.
But young people appreciate that we have Parliament, and they would like to see Parliament responding to the crisis and the challenges they have. And I don't think if anyone asks you to stay away, as long as your party guides you, so that we don't have you against your party, and then we have to defend you as a committee.
But you would defend me, you just hear that I'm out.
But I think as a committee, for instance, in things that you have shared opinions on, and you can detect.
Okay.
The,
all right, because we have also said, I think here, let's rise above and focus on real education issues. I think that should guide me, because that would be in the best interest of Parliament, but also in the best interest of the people of South Africa. As long as I don't misrepresent you, because whatever I say, it should flow from all these engagements that we have here, as long as it flows from this, and there's a majority view on the matter. So I think that, so that I don't, it would be wrong for me to express personal views when I have been employed here, and I'm representing Parliament. Yeah, I think it's fine, but I understand. Thank you very much for your understanding, but I'm sure you also wanted to say your last word on this one.
Chair, my message to distinguish, you know, I don't think, Okay, just to distinguish, the chairperson can go out and say, as myself, you know, as chairperson, this is, you know, what I'm commenting on.
But there's this thing called discipline.
But there's a difference also, just to distinguish between speaking on behalf of the members of the portfolio committee and then speaking as an individual or
mm-hmm.
chairperson of the committee.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to see that distinction and
mm-hmm.
say that we must go with the current convention
yeah.
as well.
But so far, I think Parliament will allow me to speak on these matters on higher education because I'm employed by Parliament. They will expect me to speak as a chairperson of the
yes.
committee. But then, let's be honest, let's allow each other freedom of expression.
Mm.
If in your party you want to say something, I think you can say it without opposing the view of the committee, because then people will get confused out there. Am I right? Are you hearing me? If you want to talk about a particular political view of DA, say DA says this, but should not be coming it's from, country. Yeah, contradict. Because I will try by all means, I promise you, God has given me that skill, you know, try by all means to play my piano nicely. So that the music comes out nice and everybody is happy. Before this was contested, the DA contested me on, they are already married, they don't need a second. But it's okay, you must allow humor as well. Am I right?
Yes.
Ah, these tensions, they won't take us anyway. I mean, this work is already too much. So if we can help ourselves here and make sure that we are happy. Alright. Otherwise, it does look like we covered every area of the agenda. I don't know, Ma, if you still want to say something?
That we'll ever talk about the issue of
statements
again. Okay.
Yeah. No, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right, we are very happy. I'm very happy with the state of preparedness. I can pick it up when people have prepared themselves. And I think this is the way to go. From the very first meeting, you remember, I said, what is important is that we are upskilled on oversight function, because it's a skill in itself. Next. I have requested Prof to use, Professor Habib to use the research section, no? Policy analysis section, to assist us with a tool. You know, it's called an oversight tool, but in the terminology, it will be monitoring and evaluation tool.
Mm.
I think we can use it as and when we wish. I mean, you can see they are neutral, but they will assist us because they also have got interest. So we're sharing same interest here, so we'll assist one another. But thank you so much, and in the next meeting, if we can have it the same way, oh, I'll enjoy everybody's fault in this meeting. You know that. I was not forced to, but people voluntarily and spontaneously responded to issues. That's the way to go. Thank you very much, and may God bless you, and the meeting stands adjourned.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you.